Welcome, one and all, to episode 98 of Ladies with Gumption, Fate's Knocking. We are the Ladies with Gumption. We recap DCTV in a flash, and you can find us at DCTV Gumption on Twitter, at ladieswgumption.gmail.com if you want to send us feedback, or at ladieswgumption.twitter.tumblr.com. I am Tatiana, and I am here with
Jessica
and May.
And you can find us also, still more places you can find us, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, probably not Facebook. And if you are a Patreon, you get this 24 hours early. Thank you for your Patreonage. And you will also be eventually listening to our Elite thus far review, as well as watching HBO when the season ends. Starting off, we had an article on the future of DC films, which sounded like maybe they were talking about going more rated R, and also doing different origin stories. What are your thoughts on the article? It was kind of mostly like ifs and maybes, right? It wasn't like solid,
right.
Really
it was
solid
like a
information.
Whole big like plan of like what they want to do and how they want to use like their new platform on HBO and all this other stuff. And I remember seeing, I don't know if it was included in that article specifically, but there's other talk about, you know, what to do with Superman. That was one of like the big takeaways. People were all pointing out, you know, that the WB executives were unsure of how to make Superman relatable. And they were taking pitches from like Michael B. Jordan and, you know, different things. So I thought that was interesting because like a lot of people on Twitter, like he is an undocumented immigrant. And like, so you can't make that relatable. Like that kind of story doesn't resonate with the times we're in now. Like, I don't understand. Which I think is a very valid point. And it's kind of weird, I guess, that you can't make Superman, or they think that they can't make Superman relatable, but you can have like a million different versions of a billionaire turned superhero in a bat suit scaring criminals.
I don't know. Yeah. I feel like it shouldn't be that hard to make Superman relatable, but okay.
It isn't. I think they just need to get someone who understands who Superman is as a character, because a lot of people wrongly
just
claim
like
that he's very boring.
And
it's just like there's so much history there, and I think that people are put off, I guess, by the fact that he's so powerful that they claim that there's no weakness to him, but he's also very relatable. There's like multiple dimensions to him that you can explore him as, like a romantic hero, as a man with who has to live his entire life kind of being an outcast, and all of these different angles. But I think that they're just lazy in their thinking.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't know. It seems strange to me. Like a man who loves and helps those who hate him, and who makes a home in an alien world. My God, that's crazy. That sounds like an entire religion that has been based off of that. But okay, several entire religions actually.
Mm-hmm. But, nothing like. One of the takeaways from like the article is that now like WB has a little bit more confidence that they're on the upswing because of the whole, you know, Wonder Woman did great, Aquaman did great, Joker did really great, and so now they think that they are hitting like their stride with the new heads that they have behind the scenes. Like they said, like before there's too many cooks in the kitchen basically. And so it's, like, pulling everything in different directions, and they're trying to, like, compete with Marvel without actually doing the groundwork to set up a movie that could compete with Marvel and the Avengers and on that level. So hopefully they're not being presumptuous and saying, like, we're great now, and then the next couple movies come out and they're, like, trash. But,
I think as long as – I mean, people have always said this about them. It's just, like, stick to what you're good at and don't focus on competing with Marvel. That's been like 20 something movies. You're like, you're never going to get there if you don't have the patience to just do your own thing, you know? So,
yeah. So,
so true.
That's that on that.
Anyway, Kevin Conroy talked about playing Bruce in Crisis. This is his first time actually embodying Bruce in live action. And he talked about, first off, how different it was for him and how different the Bruce that we're going to find in Crisis is. It does sound like he's the Kingdom Come Bruce, right?
Yeah.
So he'll come from the same world as Brandon Routh Superman. Thoughts on that?
I'm just interested to see him in live action because it's awkward for him and it's awkward for us in a way because we've only known him to be the voice of Batman. So now he's like also the look of Batman. And I mean, he looks pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested to see like how he factors into all of the Crisis stuff because from what we know, like there hasn't been, there's been promotion for it, but not, I guess, I don't know if they're avoiding, trying to avoid spoilers or whatnot, because it's
coming out. I mean, I don't think he's going to have that big of a role, honestly. I think, yeah, like, Kara and Kate are going to go find him, and then he's going to give, like, some, like, cryptic advice, or you can't do this, or you can do this, but then he's not going to fight.
Oh.
Yeah, because, like, the fight scenes that we have seen are just mostly the heroes that we know already.
I mean, I feel like he'll
supervisor have a... Bruce.
Yeah. I feel like he'll be larger than we originally assumed he would be of a role, because we definitely, I feel like we were like, okay, blink and you miss a cameo, just like all of them. But I agree that he probably won't fight, and it'll probably just be, he'll probably just be like within one episode, it'll probably just be a couple of scenes. However, yeah. I do already know that he is better suited to the role of Bruce than certain other people that we have seen inhabit the role of Bruce lately. So, I'm excited. And specifically to old Bruce, to, you know, a Batman Beyond S.
Batman
Bruce.
Beyond Bruce. Yeah.
Anyway, with that in mind, we have a, actually really not that one, but the next topic that is a more serious real world topic. Melissa Benoist did a video on IGTV opening up about her own experience with domestic partner violence or intimate partner violence. Which 1 in 4 women have suffered from. And, you know, as she was describing what had happened to her and what she went through and how she got out of it, it was pretty clear who the man in question was. But she shared, you know, a hotline to call if you are in a relationship that you need help getting out of, or if you need to talk to someone, either about what you've gone through, what you're currently going through, or what someone you know is going through. And, you know, a lot of people came out in support of her, including her current husband, Chris, who it sounds like he's been very supportive through it all, and that's great to see. Mm-hmm. So just basically want to say that we are really proud of Melissa and that we applaud her for coming forward, for sharing her story, hopefully inspiring several women, you know, hopefully hundreds of women to come forward or to, you know, find the strength within themselves and within their communities to break away from those kinds of relationships and to move forward from them once they have happened. Mm. Would anyone else like to share thoughts?
Because the time difference, when I woke up, she had already released the video and I had seen like tweets talking about the video, and it took me a while. One, because it was like during like the week for me, so I had to go to work. But like seeing the tweets about it were just very heavy, and it took me a while to kind of like mentally prepare myself to kind of watch the video and hear her words and how she talked about it. I thought she was very brave. It was very, it probably took like a lot of time writing down her thoughts and organizing her thoughts, and I thought it was very beautifully spoken. She spoke very eloquently about it, and not matter of fact, but not very like she was painting herself in like a certain way or painting the situation a certain way. She's kind of like very open and honest about the situation and the facts, how they were. And you can see like a lot of like growth and how much she had to process it and where she's moved from it by how she spoke about it. And it kind of puts, I think, into perspective again, like her, just her as a person, and how she's able to be like the very positive and bubbly kind of person that a lot of people have gotten to know her as. I think it's, you know, a lot of her castmates stood up for her on Twitter and applauded her and were saying, like, just, you know, the reason that she's so authentic as Kara and as Supergirl is because she is, like, a real-life Supergirl. And it's not just saying that. I think that it really does prove that she, like, how brave she was to do that and that she really is, like, a Supergirl. Like, it's not just saying that just to say that because she plays it on TV, but she actually kind of really embodies that. I just want to give her a hug. Like, when I was watching, I was like, I want to hug you right now. But yeah, it was very strong of her to do that. And I hope it does encourage a lot of people, men and women, going through that kind of thing. And maybe hearing her words kind of helps someone else go through the same thing and reflect and see that they too can find a way out. So,
yeah, I agree with all that. I think it was very hard to watch her speak on it, even to see her in a way relive all of that pain to the public, because no one knew anything about any of this that was going on with her. And we saw videos of her that people have posted, resurfaced videos about her interviews on various late night shows about how she was talking about, you know, poking fun at herself for being a klutz, when essentially we know now what really happened with her. And it's just, it takes a lot of strength and bravery to post something like that online, knowing what, you know, like the bombardment of people that are going to be in your mentions, whether that's positive or negative, and all of these things. And so, like, I really applaud her for doing something like that in order to help other women in those types of situations, or men in those situations. So it's really great that she did come out to speak on it, but also that she's in a better place. Like, I'm happy that she's out of that relationship and that she's able to talk about, like, she's finally able to open up about it, because I know that's very hurtful, and it takes, like she said, it's going to take the rest of her life to really get over it and heal from it, because it affects you mentally and physically. And so, yeah, I also wanted to give her a hug, and it's just, like, very affecting to listen to her story. And I hope that people do take something away from it, in hopes that her strength will give other people strength to leave those types of situations.
And a number that you can call if you are in that type of situation, or if you know someone who is 1-800-799-7233. It's the National Domestic Violence Hotline. So, now we will talk about some fictional ladies with their own strength. And the person leading this episode will be our lovely May. Side A is parting gift / calculated risk, and will not include Supergirl, unfortunately, because it and Batwoman were off this week. But it will include Arrow, followed by Black Lightning, and then on side B, The Flash, and Titans. So, likes, dislikes, our predictions, if any. And then we will talk Lady with Gumption of the Week.
Excellent. Yes, I am your host for this episode. We're going to kick it off with Arrow. You can't fight your fate. After being double-crossed by Lila, Oliver finds himself facing a life or death situation that seems very familiar, because we see Quentin has returned in this alternate sort of reality. Laurel, meanwhile, has the opportunity to make amends with the past and to truly take steps forward into becoming the hero that Quentin has always known that she is deep down. David Ramsey directed the episode, written by Anna Lee Hunter Hughes and Maya Houston. What sparked joy?
I said last week that this episode, that my favorite episode was the one that was last week, but, like, now this week is my favorite episode. I think David Ramsey did a great job directing. I thought the script was on point. So Annalie Hunter Hughes and Mike Houston are on my like watch list now for, well, I guess we only have like 2 episodes left. I'm sorry, girls. But if they move on to any other shows, because I really like this episode from beginning to end. I feel like Oliver said at one point he didn't understand why the monitor was sending him on all these like useless missions, like when he was talking to Lila. And that is exactly how I felt about all the episodes in the beginning of the season. I was like, why are we doing this? Like, something about it felt off. And I was like, you know, is this how you're going to end your show? Like, come on now. This doesn't really feel like Arrow. But I feel like the closer that we get to Crisis and to the end of the show, really, I feel like the episodes are really starting to hone in on the spirit of the show and what feels like Arrow. And I feel like they're going to, it's driving towards a very satisfying end to Oliver's story overall. I liked the use of the Groundhog Day trope to learn a lesson, and that was used for both Laurel and Oliver, as those two were the ones that were fighting so hard against the Monitor's plan to begin with. The return of Quentin and having him represent someone that's important to both Oliver and Laurel, and both of them learning their lessons through how much Quentin meant to both of them, I thought was really well done. It connects both Oliver and Laurel in a way, and then like Quentin having that much of an impact on both of their lives, that he is like the one through which they learn the lesson. Like just Quentin and how he interacts with Laurel, even though it's not technically his Laurel from his Earth, he still treats her very much so as his daughter, calling her like baby girl and just being like really soft with her. And even though she's like, you know, I'm not your daughter, right? And he's like, yeah, you are, basically. I thought their relationship was one of the best things about Earth 2 Laurel and her growth from the beginning. I love that she was able to graduate from the Groundhog's Day reality after finally getting to talk and to say what she wanted to say and hear what she wanted to hear from Quentin. Like she and Oliver both thought it was a pragmatic solution to get out of this world. And actually, it was something very different, very personal for both of them. And especially for Laurel, I feel like she has been playing hero. You know, she was pretending to be good. She was pretending to be Ewan Laurel. And then she actually kind of evolved into something that she actually wanted to change. And I feel like for a while, maybe she was just still trying in her head to live up to Quentin's expectation or live up to Ewan Laurel. And that was the reason behind it, you know, her going back home and doing all the things that she was doing. But then actually through talking to Quentin and having him, you know, tell her that he's proud of her and tell her that he knows that she's a hero, it kind of feels like her hero's journey was solidified in that moment. And she could finally stop pretending to be a hero or in her head and actually know that she is one, that she accomplished that goal of being someone that he was proud of. So I thought that was really nice for her. And I also like how the episode used Quentin's early on antagonistic relationship with Oliver / the Hood and paralleled that to Oliver's current antagonistic relationship with the Monitor to illustrate to Oliver that he and the Monitor were actually on the same side and that they shouldn't be kind of fighting against each other. And I like how the whole point of his journey in his mind, Groundhog's Day, was not even really necessarily related to saving Quentin, but just to come to the realization that all this time, all season, some part of him had been trying to like fight his fate, and that his suspicion of the Monitor boiled down to like, if I can prove this guy's a fraud, then that means that there's a chance that I don't die and I can survive. And how that had been unconsciously like driving him the whole time. And I feel like we finally got that explanation of why the kids were brought into the present to begin with. Like, that was really weird when they just popped up and, you know, came into the present. But the fact that it was like the Monitor's present to Oliver and his way of like giving Oliver and I guess and Diggle time with their kids before, you know, they die. Especially Oliver, because he deserves that. It's like, you know, his gift for being the hero and sacrificing his sacrifices for Crisis. And he deserves to know that because of his sacrifice, his kids will survive and not only survive, but thrive in the future. So I thought that was really, really sweet. Loved his goodbye to them and his goodbye to Quentin. And I love that the final episode that we get before Crisis goes back to where everything started on Lian Yu. So it's like a full circle kind of thing. So Arrow is doing like really, really good in terms of setting up Crisis and Oliver's story in relation to Crisis.
Yes, it definitely is. In fact, I wish that Oliver would call up Barry and tell him what the monitor's doing. And then Barry would be like, wow, I guess I'm not dying because the monitor is not bothering with me.
Right. The monitor doesn't care about Barry at all. Barry doesn't get any gifts from the future.
But anyway, yeah, I mean, I don't know that I can even, you know, add to what you said, because everything that you liked about the episode is what I liked about the episode. I loved how they incorporated Quentin, of course, as soon as they watched the episode, or as soon as they knew about the episode, and May was like, your man is in it. And I was like, my man? Quentin! So
I thought it was a K-pop star.
That's fair. Like, that's fair.
I was like, who is my man gonna be? And it was Quentin. As deserving of that title as anyone could be. So yeah, I was really excited to see him, and I was really intrigued by the way that they used the Groundhog Day structure. I love that they even called it out in the episode itself, and like different characters had a different reaction to it, right? Like, was it Quentin? He was like, so you're living the plot of a Bill Murray movie? And I was like, that's funny.
And like his and Laurel's like generation gap, because he's like Groundhog's Day. She's like, I was thinking Tom Cruise.
right, exactly.
Edge of Tomorrow.
Yes, she called it Edge of Tomorrow while they were calling it Groundhog Day. Yeah, I love that. So yeah, overall, I thought it was really cool how in this episode, both the audience and Laurel/Oliver's perceptions were changed, right? Starting off being like, okay, the monitor is punishing us, right? This is because I found out Lila's secret or whatever. So this is like this like timey-wimey mind warp thing in order to like prevent people from finding out that Lila betrayed the team, or, you know, monitors saying like, oh, you've defied me too many times, whatever, right? Using Quentin to torture them. And then instead it turned out that it was to be a gift and it was, you know, to help them let go. So I really like that. I was even kind of interested in the need to, you know, try to stop the bomb from going off. Like, I was actually, like, waiting to see how they would figure it out. So I followed along with the episode even through the various iterations. I super loved how Quentin just believed them about the time loop. He's like, I've been through enough to, you know, to know that this is probably something that happens. This could easily happen in Star City. And of course, the Laurel and Quentin interactions were my favorite thing. And I definitely cried when he called her baby girl. And when she realized, or when she told him that he died for her. And then he was like, oh, best way I could have gone.
Tears.
So, yes. Tears. I really, really loved their dynamic. Of course, I loved him as a character. So I thought this was definitely my favorite blast from the past, right? It's my favorite like send off to this character episode, and that it was a really creative way to bring him in, since he is in fact dead. And also I liked I don't know, like how in this little, like, I mean, I guess it was a real thing that was happening, but like in all the iterations, like Oliver was really soft with his kids, and the kids were like, you know, like everyone's like in a good place now, right? Like, oh, hey, dad. And like having an argument about Belly Burger. And at the end, he's like, you know, I'm like super glad that you guys are here and we have this time before crisis. Okay, gonna go die now. See you later. So yeah, overall. And also, yes, David Ramsey did an excellent job. I forgot that he was directing the episode. And then I remembered and he did really well. So I really think that the season of Arrow is shaping up to be a really solid one and a really excellent exit for the series.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, not to completely add on what you guys were saying, but I feel like Arrow and Flash specifically this week mirrored each other for the first time this season, in that they both mess with the hero's mind. Only Arrow's episode has been properly leading up to this moment for Oliver. And I like that the monitor still came off as like a generally solid presence despite his absence in the actual episode. Like, they used Lila as the person Oliver and Laurel were both connected to, specifically after her, you know, presumed betrayal. And they were shocked that she was working with him, even as she worked to teach them a lesson through the monitor. So she was like, you know, the little messenger coming through. He's like, you have to learn why you're here. So all that was great. Like, her, even her moments were a bit shocking. Her coming in to shoot Quentin was really off-putting. But it worked out within the, you know, the episode itself. And then I really enjoyed the fact that for the first time, it's kind of, I think throughout all the reunion tours for Arrow, this one felt very personal and more emotional versus, like, I liked the premiere where you had his mom and you had Tommy and he was interacting with them, but they weren't really his mom and his Tommy versus, like, this was actually Quentin as he knew him, except with an alternate twist of he actually did survive the shooting. So it was nice to have that kind of have closure for Oliver, because him and Quentin have had such an antagonistic relationship for so long, and now they've come to the realization that, you know, if I like the, when Quentin said specifically that his girls trusted Oliver, and therefore he felt like that's when he could trust him too, because for so long they were kind of rooting for the same things. They wanted the same things for their city, but now they were both realizing that they were better off knowing those things about each other. So it was like very emotionally effective. And I really, really loved the fact that he was solidifying Laurel as a hero, because she, for so long, she's been an outcast. She's done some pretty horrible things. She's been cast aside by the main team and, you know, thrown for a loop. And she's tried to inhabit a person she thought that she should be. Whereas I feel like this season, E2 Laurel has really hit her stride in that she knows who she is. She knows who she wants to be. She knows who she's kind of getting her own little validation over her being just herself and being accepted as herself. So to get that confirmation from Quentin, of all people, someone she has respected the most and someone who never gave up on her, to have her say that she is a hero and she always has been, really, I like that. That's when her loop closed, which was great to see. Yeah, so it's like a generally solid episode in terms of like emotional action. I love Groundhog Day stories. I like the little Edge of Tomorrow shout out, because I love that movie too, and it never gets enough respect. So it was like all great to come to that conclusion, whereas like it was the next natural step in Oliver's journey towards crisis. But what did not spark joy?
I like, you know, nothing did not spark joy, I guess. I mean, like, there's like little, you know, annoying things, like the lady at the party that had like the loudest and most like annoying laugh ever. Every time like Oliver opened the elevator doors, she's like, like, come on, like, shut up.
Not that funny. Wow. What a thing to focus on.
That one guy that was like with the arrow, you know, what's the difference between the arrow and the cop? And I was like, I really wished in one of those iterations, like, Oliver would have just like punched him, and like that would have been a joke. That would have been worth laughing at. But I mean, like, you know, I guess like the whole watching Quentin die multiple times was, you know, but it's just like minor stuff that's not really worth podcast time.
I mean, yeah, that's my feeling too. There isn't really anything that I disliked about the episode. Of course, in a perfect world, we would have spent just as much time on Laurel, you know, realizing what situation she's in and dealing with her side of the monitor equation or whatever, you know. But obviously it's not Laurel's show, it's Oliver's show, so I can't really bitch about that. And I thought what they gave her was really good. So aside from that, I was going to take the cop guy. The guy who said, what's the difference between the drug and the cop? And you stole it from me. So instead, I have nothing. You know what? I think just in general, like, that, like, little quips like that, the stuff that they did to indicate that time is, you know, looping, were a little bit trite. Like, some, like, it's a little bit, like, little, like, cheesy, like, lines you would find in a movie like Groundhog Day, right, in order to be like, look, indication that things are repeating. But yeah, that's going to happen any, you know, whenever that's the situation. So it was fine. Yeah. There we go.
Yeah. I mean, in general, I agree. There aren't that many dislikes about this episode, but I I know that David Ramsey did direct and his hands were full, but I will say that it was kind of frustrating that he had no point of view on the matter of his wife's betrayal. Like, if this was Oliver and Laurel's story to work through, like, some of their confusion about Lila working with the monitor, but, like, Diggle doesn't get that. Like, this is his wife, you know? Like, he would feel the most betrayed over the fact that she didn't tell him these things.
And, right, especially because we have to assume that it's not a, she lied about it being a double, like, she's a double agent, right? Like, that's not true.
Right.
So it would be nice to actually see what his real reaction to the actual truth is.
Yeah, exactly. But I feel so like it's
his like role as a character is just to be accepting of things the most anyway. And I don't know if that's like part of his like magical Negro character trope or whatever, but like his opinion does seem to matter the least on most things.
Which is frustrating. So I thought that decision to exclude him was kind of weird, especially after like the end of the last episode. And small annoying nitpick, but Connor calls Diggle dad, but he calls Lila Lila. So eyebrow raise. I don't know. That's divorce. Interesting.
Well, I guess
dies in crisis.
Yeah. Either she dies or maybe it's because they're in the present and like Diggle is already well aware of the situation and maybe Lila's not as much. I don't know.
Yeah,
instead of the time with Lila, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't
know. Yeah,
I guess. I don't know.
But yeah, maybe. Yeah. Maybe she does die. Although, I don't know. I feel like the way they talked about them, they were together. So this was
confusing. Right. So well, I guess we'll see what crisis will change. But again, and also Quentin dying over and over again. Like, I didn't need to see that. But it happened. But it sucked. Any predictions?
I will say that the only person that matters that we have not seen yet on this, like, goodbye world tour is Slade. And seeing as how last time we left him, he was on the NU, and now we're back on the NU, I wonder if Manu Bennett is going to make another appearance next week. So I feel like that is the only remaining thing that has not been checked off the bucket list for Arrow. So that's my prediction of he's going to be involved in whatever the mission is somehow for the next episode.
I think that's a solid prediction, especially given that the future, the kids are supposedly dealing with the Deathstroke gang. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with this. But do you have any predictions, Tati?
No, I love piggybacking off of
Jessica's predictions because I have none of my own.
All right, and I don't either, per usual. Moving on to Black Lightning, and Tasha did not send us an email, so we do not have predictions from Tasha. Yeah. Tasha.
We can't crave hers. Oh, damn it.
Yes, but moving on to Black Lightning, we have Anissa who reaches out to Jefferson for help because she can only handle so much. They have a heart-to-heart, and she tells him she needs Black Lightning's help in escorting Meta refugees out of the perimeter. Meanwhile, Gambi implores Lynn to help get him access to the pit where they meet, dun-dun-dun, Khalil. Lastly, Jennifer grows closer to Brandon, sort of, over him needing information about Dr. Jace. And unfortunately, Agent Odell is not dead. So he's very much alive, but the ASA has been taken over by an even more annoying person who shall not spark joy for us. So what did spark joy before we get there?
Tell me what sparks joy for me. No, definitely was not her. Am I going first?
Yeah, you can go first.
Oh.
Straight off.
I don't like that. Okay. So I will say that Anissa reaching out to her father and, you know, Black Lightning being the one to escort Grace definitely sparked joy. I was very much needing them to repair their relationship because they were in a really rocky place. And I loved that when Jefferson showed up, he was like, are you going to kick me out of your house again? So yes, call her out on that. But yeah, I like that she trusted him enough for it. And I liked that, you know, even though she did not reveal to Grace that her father was Black Lightning, you know, it's super obvious, but she used her, you know,
leopard
senses. Yeah, I was like, feline, which cat is this? I'm getting all my wild cat transformations mixed up. But yes, her leopard senses to realize that it was him and that she trusted him for that reason, right? So, like, I'm skipping the end here. But when she became, you know, when she went into the feral leopard mode, and Jefferson showed up, she was, like, immediately calmed by his presence, right? And the fact that he hadn't abandoned her instead of him having to actually, like, you know, talk her out of it, or like get Anissa on the phone, or like actually fight Leopard Grace. I was like gearing up for like some kind of conversation, and then she was like, "Oh my god, you didn't abandon me!" So, yay for that. father daughter in law dynamics. And I do think that this was a decent send off for Grace for now, right? Because we can assume we're not going to see her for a while. Which, speaking of, I feel like Chantal Thoy saw us talking shit, not necessarily specifically us, but, you know, people talking shit about the fact that Grace is never around, or the way that Grace and this relationship has developed. And she did, like, apropos of nothing, be like, "I'm so grateful to the Black Lightning team for, like, working me in right. and working around my Broadway schedule and letting me come on Mondays." We definitely thought
she was not on here as yeah. much as she was.
Yeah. We were like, so yeah. So I thought that was, it was a good workaround. And again, another showcase of how Nafisa has grown as an actress, I think. She was really good in this episode as well. I was very proud of her. So yeah, so that whole storyline was pleasing to mine eye. Especially that Anissa was able to be open with her father and still, you know, still touching on what happened to Trayvon and how, and what happened to her, but not like fully pulling the blame on her dad or, you know, having another real standoff about it. Meanwhile, I liked Yambi and Lynn's differing perspectives on painkiller Khalil. Right? Like, Yambi was like, "Kill it!" And Lynn was like, "No, that's my baby's friend!" Even after knowing what happened to his mom. She was like, "That wasn't Khalil. That was painkiller. If I have failed to save 16 kids so far, I will save this 17th one. It's going to happen." So, I mean, I don't have faith in you, Lynn. I wish I could say I did, but I'm rooting for you. I'm hoping you pull through this time. So yeah, I thought that was really interesting. And also, I just, you know, Jordan is just having so much fun in that role, that as much as I hate what's happening, you know, to Khalil, and obviously the way that he's behaving, I just, his scenes are just, like, fun to watch, even as they are not fun. Not fun to experience. I also, yeah, I was very much sparked joy that despite the episode being called Henderson's Opus, I really thought, I thought Henderson was going to kick it. And he did not. He made it through. It was his opus because it was like his plea to Jefferson to like stand and like firm in the light or whatever, you know, and stand up against the ASA. And I support you in this Henderson. I was like, I am 100% Team Henderson. So yay, he lives to fight another day. Also, I like Jennifer, you know, like sort of, you know, offering to track down Jace for Brandon, and then despite things going awry, going sour with them for now, or, you know, hitting a roadblock, she still has like located Jace, and she is like, you know, hopefully we're gonna have a conversation there, right, as she inches closer to hopefully uncovering the truth. Also, her standoff, or, you know, whatever arguments, if you will, her tentative partnership that she was clearly displeased with chick who is not Odell.
Jared Gray.
Sure. Whatever that chick's name is.
Yeah, made sure.
were, like, China was really fun to watch in them, and it did make me, like, for like I was like, I see why Odell might be slightly superior to this woman, you know?
Oh, definitely.
So, yeah. And I think Jennifer did a good job of showing that, but also it's, like, clearly not blind allegiance either, right? As much as she does seem to have a soft spot for Odell, she's not just going to do whatever the ASA says just because the ASA said it. So I think that's that on that.
Yeah. I think for most episodes this season, I enjoy the episodes. I think they're solid episodes. I would guess for, you know, this one in particular, I agree with you about Nafisa's acting once again. I think she's stepped up considerably since season one. And her scenes with Grace, like the relaxation scene when like Grace is like freaking out and they walk through their whole relaxation practice or whatever, you know, to calm her down. I kind of wish like I don't know why Grace can't do that herself. Like, can Anissa give like Grace, like Shonda, access voice control so she can also do this relaxation routine even when she's not here? But anyway, I liked that scene and the goodbye scene, and I liked her plea to Jefferson, because I think it took a lot for Anissa to do that. Both Jefferson and Anissa have really large egos in terms of like pride. They're very proudful people, and that can sometimes make them very stubborn. It has gotten to the point that she can't use her powers to protect Grace or any of the other kids, and so, and she knows that Jefferson is on the wrong side of the resistance at the moment. Like, they're not, the resistance and Black Lightning aren't really seeing eye to eye. But she asks her dad for help. She kind of lowers down her pride and asks for his help because he's still like her dad and he's still like a good guy and he still wants to help. That's his core of who he is. So she kind of appeals to that. Which is good because Jefferson needed a win this week. So this was his opportunity to get a win. So I like that. And then the special effects of Brandon and Jennifer's powers are cool. So yay for that. The only other thing I think that really, really sparked joy for me is, I agree with you, like watching Khalil, which is really weird because we hated him. Hated him when he was a quote unquote good guy, or when he was still Khalil. Hated him when he's like a mindless robotic assassin. Love him.
What does this say about us?
Weird, but I just love him. And I love watching his scenes. And I think, I mean, it's got to be because of Jordan Calloway, but you know, his are probably like the most enjoyable of the season so far. So yeah, that's what sparks joy for me.
Yeah, I completely agree with all of these things. I think for me, what really stood out is how Jefferson's relationship, like I feel of all the relationships Jefferson has this season, his most important one has been with Anissa, because they've kind of gone head to head, faced off against each other for whatever reason. Like, I felt like they were always arguing a lot. So it was nice to finally see them be on the same page. And it was really actually nice to see, because for me, Anissa's often been portrayed as this woman who's, you know, strong. She needs to do all these things on her own. And she doesn't need any backup. She's, you know, she can do all of these things. She doesn't need any help. And so it was nice for her to be vulnerable in that moment, specifically to her dad, that she does need help. She can't do all these things on her own. She's only one person. And one person can only handle so much. They always need some kind of a support at some point down the line. So it was nice to see her open up, because between Grace and the resistance and everything that's happening with ASA, it became too much. And it was nice to see that come to a head in this episode. So I really love that moment. And I completely agree about Anissa, Nafisa Williams's acting having gotten so much better for her to be able to convey like all of these emotions. So that was a very strong moment. And I really liked the fact that even though, well, I don't know if I would say I like this, but I found it really interesting that Gambie is like sort of in the middle of all of these things without actually, he knows all of these secrets about the Pierce family right now, but he's not really telling anybody else. Yeah. I want him to find out
that Lynn is a crackhead. Find that out, Gambie.
Yeah. So like, that's interesting, I guess, to see how that's going to, how that's going to work moving forward. What else? I really liked, I didn't like some of the aspects of it, but I did like in general Jennifer and Brandon's powers and their growing relationship, even though they seem like they're being antagonists towards each other. Jennifer's withholding information about Jace because she didn't have it, but she kind of wanted to keep Brandon around. So I feel like that relationship will grow more in the coming episodes. But I did like the fact that there's somebody who can actually tame her powers or they can like share powers. I don't know. Like, there's a connection there that involves their powers, which is nice to see, because Jennifer's kind of been on the outside of all the things that have been happening. So at least she has someone. Yeah, but it's a strong episode for Jefferson finally getting that win, like you guys said, and it was nice to see him be a hero, and it was nice to finally see someone be rescued in this episode after having seen so many people die this season. Which did not spark joy.
Even though, like, I already, you know, I feel like they did it well, and I understand that Chantal has other things happening. I do feel sad that we're going to lose Grace again for a while. And thus I have to worry about what Anissa will be up to in her absence, but that's all right. Aside from that, I like the idea that Jennifer has found someone who can temper her powers, or that, you know, there might be a symbiotic relationship with those, with their powers. But I do feel like the dynamic that they're having right now is a bit of a, like, I don't know, stop and start, merry-go-round, kind of like going in circles a bit, right? So I want it to move forward one way or the other, and hopefully it will soon. Aside from that, I don't know. I feel like I also want to see Lynn move forward from her crackhead ways and for someone to, like, notice. Because I feel like she and Jefferson are still just kind of, like, in this, like, weird, like, on-the-outs situation while still, you know, being ostensibly together, that they have been all season, and that I would like maybe Jefferson to really, like, wake up and pay attention to what is going on, right? Especially because I feel like it must parallel in some ways how Lynn felt when Jefferson was out heroing, you know, back in the good old days when she eventually ended up leaving him because he wouldn't leave the hero life behind or whatever, you know? And now she's the one that's doing dangerous and reckless things and keeping things from him, because she's trying to be her own kind of hero. Yeah, but otherwise, overall, I mostly like the episode. Well, I mean, okay, the lady who is not Odell did not spark joy. This is true. She was incredibly annoying. And yeah, if you're going to make Odell look good, then you have a problem. That's all.
Yeah, I think overall, like I said before, overall with a lot of the episode this season, they are enjoyable. I mean, like, you know, I watch it and I'm not thinking how long is left in this episode kind of thing. So, I mean, that's great or whatever. But I also don't really feel like there's any strong connections that spark joy for me. So it's just kind of like, you know, there's stuff happening. And I feel like a lot of it, like you said, is kind of just like going in circles and stalling out. Like Jennifer's whole storyline was just a big stall, because she asked for the thing with Jace, right? And then she went and she's like chasing down Brandon, and he's like, what the fuck do you want? Like, come on, just say it or not. And she's like, oh, she's teasing all this, oh, I can help you find Jace. But she, like, I don't understand what her point was. Like, why couldn't she just wait until she got Jace to go to talk to Brandon and get him to, like, test her powers? But she's doing all this shit, like, you know, oh, let's test our powers and I'll tell you about Jace. And he's like, you know what? Fine. Test. Don't tell me what I want to know. And she's like, oh, no. Hit the blunt. One more time. Why are you wasting my time? Like, I agree with him. Like, get out. Like, stop wasting my time. Either say something or leave. So I'm not really sure what the point of that episode was, or her with Brandon, other than that one little cool special effects light scene. That was it. I don't like Sarah Gray, like Major Gray. Never liked her. Even when she was in uniform, she's a fucking asshole. So the fact that she's Odell's number two, she looks ugly in a suit. And, like, the fact that it was her, I mean, Odell and Jefferson Buttonheads is one thing, but then, like, the visual of her white woman trying to, like, boy Jefferson and get, like, order him around was annoying. And then at the end, the fact that, you know, Jefferson was caught with, like, all the kids trying to, like, cross the border, and she ordered them to shoot down kids, and these are kids, like, not just, like, kids, these are, like, meta kids. And one, like, do you want the meta humans? Like, what is the ASA's actual point? Do they want the meta humans, or do they want to destroy them all? Because I feel like Odell would have been like, capture the kids and bring them to the pit, and she's just like, shoot them down. And so clearly she is not capable of handling the most powerful position in the ASA because she's like a hot fucking mess. Well, I still don't like Lynn's storyline. I thought her arguing with Gambi was stupid. Like, Gambi's like, kill it! And her arguing of like, kill him or not kill him, fine or whatever. But the fact, like, oh my god, here's his memories. Let me access him. Oh my god, I'm gonna wake him up. He's like, don't wake him up. Like, after like, he killed his mother, and then, you know, well, that was after. They found that out afterwards. But the fact that she's like watching this stuff and they know he's dangerous, and Gamey's like, don't do it. She's like, I'm gonna do it. It was like when, like, a control. And this is like, there's this big old red button, like, do not push. She's like, I'm gonna push the button. This makes no sense to me.
She wants to save the kids.
When has that ever worked out for you, Lynn? I thought that the conversation between Henderson and Jefferson was very well acted, and I think Henderson made a lot of points. But it is kind of bothering me how Jefferson is on the wrong side of this whole situation. He's been on the wrong side the whole season, or it seems like he's on the right side, but then he's not on the right side. And, you know, I don't know, like, I don't know, I guess Freeland is fictionally in the North somewhere, because I don't know any kind of reverend in the South that drinks and curses in the name of God. In a church. That's not really a dislike. It's just like a observation, I guess.
Oh my god.
Like I like Reverend Holt. I think he's a great character, but I'm just thinking, like, ain't no way like a reverend
right.
in his house of God is cursing and you know, getting a little bit something stronger in his drink and all this kind of stuff. So that's a little bit whatever.
But that reminds me that I forgot to say my biggest like of the episode, which was Two Bits.
Yeah.
Throwing up instead of when they thought it was gonna be the ASA or the Markovians or whatever. And but yeah. It turns out they were going somewhere else. And so Reverend Holton got to shoot him in the face and it was Two Bits. Oh, that was so good.
That was an interesting moment, yeah.
Okay, sorry. Anyway.
That was there for me.
I forgot to say too in my likes that I did like the little Grace Jefferson moment and that she finally knows that he's blacklighting because that was really cute. But on that note, it's not that I dislike Grace's shapeshifting, but for me, it just feels like they don't really know what to do with her.
Yeah, there's a point to it.
Yeah, yeah. So like we're constantly getting younger Grace or old man Grace for whatever reason. And I feel like her shapeshifting is because they really, yeah, they can't commit to Chantal in this role. So they find like a way to leave her out. And in general, like her interactions with Anissa as a teen are a little bit awkward because it feels like an imbalanced relationship because it's like Anissa taking care of Grace like a child instead of as an equal partner. And we brought this up before, but it was really, I guess it's really prevalent here because it's just, it was very, for me, this episode, it was very uncomfortable to watch. Because it's, especially since Grace was leaving and, you know, she's concerned and I get it. But it was very much Anissa sort of coddling her or making sure that she's, you know, everything's going to be all right. Like you're comforting a child who's about to go into something scary for them or on a amusement park ride or something like that. That's what it sort of felt like. So it felt very uncomfortable to watch. And in general, again, they're removing her from the storyline when this past season, we haven't really gotten much of a storyline for her, like other than her being scared and sitting home alone and dealing with her, shapeshifting or whatever.
Even know we have why she shapeshifts.
Right.
Like, how long has she had this?
She ran away last season. So I really thought that, or I expected her storyline to go in the direction of learning more about Markovia, maybe her dealings with Markovia, like did they do something to her and all this history, but Markovia still also remains a little bit of a mystery as well. So we're not really getting much on that front. So it's just kind of it's stalling and it's not cool to watch every week. And then what's really frustrating in general is Jennifer's specific isolation from the rest of her family, because it's like she's living a completely separate life and she has a completely separate storyline. The last time she interacted with her parents or Anissa was when they came back from their little 60-day thing stint at the ASA headquarters. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, okay, so she's going to school. She's at home alone a lot. And there's no interaction there. And I think that's really odd considering all of these, a lot of the pieces are sort of starting to fall into place. And she's still outside of that little, the little arc that's happening. And I'm confused. Even Lynn hasn't interacted with her daughters at all. Like, she's so intent on helping the Greenlight kids and her experiments, but then there's her children who are going through these things, and she's not there for them either, and neither is Jefferson. So it's just like odd. I don't know. It's just like a weird storytelling choice. And then I also just liked Jefferson, like you guys said, he's sort of on the fence. Like, one day he's anti ASA, like, oh, they helped, you know, they kept me away from you guys. And then he's kind of taking care of business for them, which is odd. And then he had the little tiff with Henderson about not telling him about the resistance when Jefferson also lied to him for decades. So, like, Henderson had a point. So it's weird that he's not taking more of a stand. Like, I get that he's scared that the ASA might come harm his family, but he's already kind of gotten Gambi to disable the tracking in his suit. So it's not like he can't figure out a way to get around the ASA.
Yeah, Anissa did it by just creating a new identity, right?
So yeah, there you go. So it's all strange. And I completely agree about Major Gray. To have someone come in and make me wish that Odell was back is very bad. Like, she just mishandled the whole situation. She was doing things he wouldn't have ever done. She didn't know what she was doing. She was being incredibly harsh for no reason. And it was just all so stupid to watch her pretend that she was being a leader. Fun. Yeah. Like, she's terrible. And then to assume that it was okay to give Jennifer information about Jace, like, come on. Even you should know that that was not going to be a good idea.
Dumb. Like, two Pierce family members played her in the same episode. Jennifer and then Lynn.
Yeah. It's terrible. But before we get into predictions, Tati, would you like to read some of our Black Lightning feedback?
I would love to read our Black Lightning feedback. And we have so much of it. Just kidding. All right. We've got Paulina, our loyal Black Lightning watcher. And all of y'all should join her. Okay. Hi, all. I hope y'all are well. Wishing you happy Thanksgiving. Aw. Likes for Black Lightning. The closing scene, Khalil receives his next target, Black Lightning. I totally forgot. That was also, I was like, oh, yeah. Okay. It's happening. We're going to, I can't wait. So, yes, I agree with that. Terrified to see where it goes, but that was a fantastic cliffhanger. Two, and this is goodbye to Grace over the monitor. Grace couldn't hear her, but the tears streaming her cheeks were poignant and heartbreaking. Nafisa showcases just how she's grown, and I loved Gambi comforting Anissa. Agreed. I also loved Gambi's proud smile when Anissa says she installed a tracking device on the necklace she got, Grace. Jennifer finally got her own storyline outside of the ASA. The introduction of Brandon's meta abilities and his plan for revenge is giving her a new storyline. I love how she manipulated that Sarah Gray lady. I have no idea what that white woman's name is what she said. Jennifer versus Dr. Jace will be epic. Black Lightning, being out in the field, defying ASA orders. I love that we got to see Jeff out of his suit and using his, out in his suit and using his abilities frequently. And I love how he shielded the med kids from being gunned down. So he did pick, the right side. Six, I also, really loved Grace knowing that Black Lightning is Jefferson from his scent. And telling Jeff that Anissa is lucky to have such a caring father. That was really sweet. I like that. I really like their upcoming dynamic or their burgeoning dynamic. Dislikes. Lynn's storyline is still problematic, although this episode was better for her because the focus was on her and Gambi finding Khalil. I liked seeing her dedication to wanting to save Khalil, but she's still popping green light pills and I'm nervous about the ramifications. Two, my prediction for last week was correct. I'm pretty sure that everyone figured out Odell would still be alive. We hoped, though. We hoped. new ASA head is even more annoying than Odell. I agree with Lynn that she makes me miss Odell. Yep. For an episode called Henderson's Opus, there wasn't nearly enough Henderson. I wanted to see more of the dynamic between him, Reverend, and Two Bits. I really hope we see that in the upcoming episodes. I dislike that Jennifer has been very isolated. Yes, us too. I miss scenes between Anissa and Jennifer, and it's just weird that they haven't checked up on her. So true. All right. And now we can move on to Our Lady of Gumption, yeah?
For side A? Yeah.
Well, there were predictions. Do you guys have any?
Oh, sorry. I definitely don't think that Khalil will kill Black Lightning. Nor do I think that Black Lightning will kill Khalil. So this is probably going to be the time when, you know, Lynn said keep it from Jennifer, but I feel like
Jennifer's going to find out.
Yeah, Jennifer's going to find out if Khalil tries, or if Painkiller tries to kill Black Lightning.
I don't have any new, like, I said, like, last week that my prediction was that Brandon's Geoforce. I haven't really, there hasn't really been any kind of movement on that, because, like I said, the whole thing stalled out. So it really depends on what the situation with him and Jace is, like the whole backstory. But, and it, there's like a high possibility that he's not, but like, don't bring an Earthbender on a season with Markovia and the Outsiders, or Outsider like esque season, and him not be Geoforce. Right. So I'm just going to be like mad if that does not pan out. But I feel like, his relationship with Jennifer and their powers is a little weird, so I don't really know how that all, I mean, I guess like lightning is grounded in the earth,
right?
I mean, that doesn't really have anything to do with Geoforce, so I don't know, but yeah, that's still my working theory.
That's right. Aren't lightning Pokemon weak to ground Pokemon?
I think so, yeah.
I would agree, but I don't know anything about Pokemon.
That's my only contribution to that.
That is a solid, solid factual evidence to back up this theory. Yeah.
This is not a prediction, more like a worry, because I don't, it seems like obviously they're building up the whole Jennifer will save Khalil from himself because he can still, he still has his memories, and I don't like it. But it probably will happen.
I mean, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, just accept that.
It's tragic.
Just
accept that. I know.
But it's like, I mean, I don't think she has to, like, you know, make out with him to save him. I think it's just.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
You'll see her and be like, oh, that's my most emotions are happening.
Yeah. All right. So, Lady with Gumption for side A. Who do we choose?
Well, definitely Laurel for Arrow, because, like, yeah, one, she was the only lady, and two, she also deserves it.
Lila is a lady.
She was the only lady with a story. Like, Lila was just there. Lila's sure. Jiminy Cricket to guide her through.
True, true, true.
Black Lightning?
I feel like Anissa, maybe, for, you know, letting her dad in, getting her girl out.
I feel like that's weak, but I feel like she's also the only one that's been having gumption, like, all season.
Yeah, that's true. True, true. So, okay, well, Laurel and...
oh, that lady, Sarah Gray, for having the gumption to
no, fuck her.
Run Black Lightning as well. Black Lightning, run ASA.
No, moving on.
Yeah, anyway.
Side B, Blood Brothers / Things Fall Apart. We're starting with Off with the Flash, part one of the midseason finale, The Last Temptation of Barry Allen, part one. As Barry stands on the threshold of his impending death and crisis, his convictions are tested when the monstrous Dr. Ramsay Rosso infects the Flash with a mysterious hallucinogenic contagion. Meanwhile, reporter Iris West-Allen uncovers a vast conspiracy where she goes to interview a guy who ends up being killed in the same exact spot. I do not know who wrote this episode, but someone did. What sparked joy?
You go somewhere.
Is this me?
Yes.
Okay. So this, I mean, this definitely was a step up in terms of intensity and emotion from some of the previous episodes. So I think that was, you know, a good thing. The fact that for Barry, a lot of the his story was happening like within his mind. I thought the kind of blending between like reality and what's real and what's not real, and like him not knowing at first that everything was an illusion and happening in his mind, and then you kind of finding out that, you know, he has been like infected, and then he's by himself, and like, oh my God, no one knows he's alone and he's suffering, and you know, I thought, you know, that is added to the intensity of it. And then like Ramsay being inside his mind and kind of like needling away at him, the return of Speed Force, Nora, and her trying to, like, it's like the battle of good and evil going inside his mind. Grant, I think, did an amazing job portraying, like, all of the ranges of emotions that Barry was going through, especially when it came to baby Nora and him seeing, like, her in the crib. And actually, we actually get to see the baby. But, like, and then him trying to, like, pick her up and then, you know, not being able to, and he's like totally just like breaking down, like, I know it's pretend, I just want to hold my baby. And, you know, Ramsey just kind of like saying, they're like smirking, like, let him hold the baby, you monster. That was really hard to like watch, you know, Barry try to hold a child, and, you know, his imaginary child, and he can't even do that. I thought that the kind of, I think the Speed Force definitely slipped up when she said that Ramsey was telling the truth.
Yeah.
But that's not the thing to say. But I like that we did get for Barry kind of the admission that he is not really ready. Like, he doesn't want to die. And him kind of getting upset with the Speed Force of saying, like, you don't really care about me as a person. And, you know, I have to die because you say I have to die, and you the one that came into my life. You killed my mother, and you did all these things to me, and why do I have to do what you want to do? And which I think is very real and human thing for him to say, and him to not want to die, and Ramsey taking advantage of that. The demented Thanksgiving dinner is both like disgusting but actually kind of like hilarious, like especially like Candace's face, like, it's rude not to eat. It's like very gross. She did great with it. I think, let's see, what else? This is an unpopular opinion, but like Frost and, because first he had Ralph go through the thing where he almost died and she's like, I don't know what to do. And then finally they have to like call in Caitlin. And then the same thing when they finally figure out that something's wrong with Barry and they find him and he's stroking out on the table and she has like a panic attack. And I know a lot of people were, you know, annoyed that she had a panic attack when Barry's, like, dying. But I feel like it was the rational choice for that character, because I don't think that she should be a medical expert, even though they try to use her for that. So it makes sense in my mind why she would have a panic attack and not be able to do something, because that's not her field. That's not what she does. So I thought that was a very logical reaction for her in that moment, and her realizing that Caitlin needs to step in when there's medical emergencies. So that's that out of the way. And then, and on Iris's point of the story, I liked finally seeing the citizen as a trio go out and talk to, go to crime scenes, stalk this whatever dude, Maelstrom dude, and try and get the story. The fact that Iris is packing a taser, which is cool, but I still remember from season 2 when Joe was like, you carry this gun. I'm like, what happened to the gun? Now she's been downgraded to a taser. But anyway, I was ready to be annoyed at Allegra because Allegra was on some bullshit and like why she wasn't on the secret. But I did like that it turned from why didn't you tell me that Barry was the Flash to her real issue was, you know, this is happening in 36 hours somehow. Like, we're already speeded up towards 2 hours or 2 days before crisis. But the fact that something big is happening to Iris's husband, and Iris is trying to avoid it. So I like how Allegra's pushing Iris was to bring up this conversation and get Iris to stop, like, downplaying her feelings, ignoring her feelings, and how that kind of leads Iris to starting to write the article by the end of the episode. And I also like that they're building opening up into the black hole conspiracy part of it, and that the citizen is at the center of that storyline, and hopefully that continues on into post-crisis, and them continuing to like work together and unfold that mystery. So I think that's a sufficient amount of likes. And so I'm going to stop talking. Pass it off to Tati.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot to like in the episode. Like I said, it was a improvement. It was a ramp of intensity. It was just like felt like better writing. It gave more characters, despite the fact that it took place entirely, almost entirely in Barry's head. It gave characters like a better spread of things to do. Grant definitely showed off his superior acting skills in it. I remember that you could understand where Barry was coming from in at from like every angle, if you will. Like, he's on the one hand fought so hard to like keep the world safe, right? And he really does view himself as a hero and like someone who's willing to make that sacrifice, and yet the very human part of him is rebelling against that and doesn't feel like he deserves to die and wants to be able to live that life, you know, with his family and have a child with Iris and see that child grow. So like that moment, I think that like when he stabs Nora, Speed Force Nora.
With, oh my gosh, with yeah. His,
that was like horrifying.
That was very like reverse flash of him.
Exactly. Very reverse flash of him. And yet you could like, you could feel how Barry was driven to that point, you know, in his haunting of Barry Allen situation, temptation of Barry Allen situation. So I was like, okay, Grant did a really good job. And also, oh, like,
can I just like break in to say that I found that it was directed by Chad Lowe and written by Jonathan Butler and Gabriel Garza.
Oh, well, well thank done, you. Jonathan Butler and Gabriel Garza. Nickelodeon writers, no more.
They graduated to Nick at Night.
So yeah, I thought that the like, and also like, even though it's elementary, the symbolism of both sides, like pulling Barry, right? That like light versus dark tug of war, you know, summed it up well. Like, it was really well done. I thought everything that happened, Barry said, was really well done. Like, and also speaking of like send offs for characters, what a great use of Nora West Ellen, baby Nora. I, you know, tears in my eyes when Barry wanted, like you were saying, when Barry wanted to hold her and he couldn't because she was an illusion, and then when he was like seeing Iris with baby Nora, and they were like in that little like family pose, and she's even wearing her mother's necklace that he gave her, you know, looking like it's like perfect happy family. So yeah, I think it was like a really nice way to just showcase everything that he is gonna lose. Yes, the Thanksgiving scene was hilarious and gross, but yeah, it was great. Like, and it's what's funny is that like beforehand, everyone was mad that. For whatever reason, they're mad that Team Flash was like there at Thanksgiving dinner with them.
In his mind, people.
Yeah, and then turned out to be in his mind. And I was like, yeah. Although to be fair, like in real life, I'm sure, like I don't know, I go to Thanksgiving dinners with not my family, so
Friendsgiving.
Exactly, I don't find it weird. But anyway, I did think it was funny that it ended up being in his mind, and that it was just so like everyone just like, come sit down and eat this blood with us, Barry. Which is pretty much what what Bloodwork was wanting Barry to do. So it was a nice little encapsulation of the episode once again. And then aside from that, I really liked the way that he lashed out at the Speed Force, because like you were saying, like he has a point, right? He didn't ask to be the Flash. It was, you know, thrust upon him. And everything, like, all these sacrifices that he's supposed to be making, like, he doesn't know, like, there's no explanation why he has to do it, right? Why does he have to be the one to do it? It's just, like, you have to do it, balance forces in the universe, it's just like that. And yet, at the same time, this is, like, the first episode that really helps to make Ramsey a truly compelling villain, because he does have something over Barry. He has something that he can offer Barry. He has some, you know, like, he's making an argument that is actually going to be tempting to Barry, right? Like, no one has
ever... he's not lying about it.
Right, apparently he's not lying about it, which, okay. But no one has ever really successfully, I think, like, gotten to, like, the core of, like, how would you make Barry Allen backslide, right? Like, obviously he's like, oh, I could go back and save my mom, but he's never been like, yes, I'm willing to sacrifice these things to do that, right? He's always immediately tried to set it to rights. And so this would be like the fact that he lost at the end of this episode, right? Obviously just sort of a second part, but like that's like the first truly like, you know, falling off his pedestal, I guess is what I'm saying. So yeah, I thought it was really well done. All speaking of, I love that Iris was the one that realized that it wasn't Barry. Because she was like, he would not speak to me like that. Clearly that's not Barry. That is weird. blood work, Barry. So that was great. I also loved that Iris A got screen time this episode. That's a good improvement.
Yeah.
And then also that we got to see Team Citizen on the move. We're finally starting to uncover the, you know, whatever's going on with Sue, whatever the black hole-esque mystery is, and that Iris is the one leading that charge. And I'm glad that I was right about Allegra, that my faith in her was well-placed. I, you know, as soon as she saw the article, her primary concern went from no one tells me anything around here to, hey, Iris, it's really fucking weird that you are out here running around chasing this nonsense about Sue Dibney / my cousin and not actually dealing with the fact that your husband's going to die. Mm-hmm. So that's great. I loved her little speech to Iris about how Iris's article on the streak was the one that inspired her to be a journalist herself. Really nice callback to the first season, and that combined with actually, you know, facing her own feelings on the subject helped Iris sit down to compose her eventually Pulitzer Prize winning article on how
that
her
does
husband
not exist because her husband will not die.
Yes, well, I'm sure she can still write an homage, right? Even if he can live, and she can be like, hey, we all almost died and then we didn't. Take your Pulitzer and go. So anyway, I liked, thank God someone finally talked to Iris about it, basically, about how she was feeling, and gave her space to actually contemplate her own emotions. Aside from that, I liked the part of the Frost storyline that I liked, I guess, was how Cisco kind of seemed to want Frost to, like, connect with him. Like, he's trying to talk to Frost, and then Frost was like, oh, Katie and I already discussed it.
Okay.
Yeah. And then he was like, oh, okay, we can be friends too. You don't only have to be friends with the other voice inside your head.
And Ralph. The other boys and Ralph.
Yes, and Ralph. So, yeah, I thought that was interesting. Yeah, I mean, overall, I thought it was a really good episode. Well-written, well-directed. Chad Lowe knows how to create tension and get good performances. So, yeah. I'm done.
To get it out of the way, my favorite Frost moment was when Ralph was seizing on the hospital bed and she's like, don't we need to take that road trip, coach? It's like, oh, look, her and Ralph are bonding. I think that's probably like the best relationship that she has outside of her weird interactions with Caitlin. Yeah. but besides that, yeah, I mean, to generally echo what you ladies have said about this episode with regards to the strength that it had, the power that it had. because it was a pretty strong episode in terms of like writing and everything. I would almost call it one of the best episodes thus far of the series, with certain nitpicks that will come later on. But I feel like it's hard to follow up the Runaway Dinosaur in terms of like Barry's interactions with the Speed Force. And I think that this episode really took it to the next level because it was very different even for the Flash. There's a lot of ways to do mind fucks, which I always love, but this one built tension in a different way where it's like every time Ramsey spoke or Barry said something, they were suddenly somewhere else and he was seeing something different. And he was seeing different people speak to him about exactly what it was that he was losing. Like his fears were coming to him from the people that he loves, like Iris wearing like funeral garb. It's like, you'll leave me alone forever. Constantly about Iris being a widow or losing the family that he's always wanted with her. And I really like the fact that even though she wasn't present in the present with him when he was going through this, that she was at least like an important part of his mindscape while he was trapped inside. Like his pause when Speed Force Nora was telling him that he will lose if he, you know, succumbs to Ramsey, he'll lose all the parts of himself that Iris loves. And he, like, you see his face change, and about how you know, because it's true, Barry has been living in the past a lot, or like in previous seasons, he has lived in the past versus now that he has something to live for. And he, you know, lists like he got married, he's going to have a baby with Iris and all these things that are important to him. That's something he has for himself that he can finally see a future for himself. Whereas before he was more willing to give up certain things because he thought that he either this was his perfect life or he was okay knowing that he had to sacrifice himself. So it was very, very human of him to finally actually want to fight for his life. Like, it's what I've wanted from him since like last season, ever since he found out that he was not going to return from wherever he went. 25 years later, I've wanted Barry to step up and be like, no, I have a lot of things to live for. Like, I'm not just going to roll over and die. I want him to put up a fight. Just like Oliver has been questioning the monitor about, like, is this really what I have to do? What about my family and all this other stuff? Barry's finally coming to that realization. And it was really, really great to see. And once again, like, Grant puts up a great, great, phenomenal performance. Probably his one of his best one yet, because it was just the tension was building. And you could see, like, Barry's health deteriorating from how he was, like, his look to the fever sweat to everything that was going on in his head was escalating. And you could see that in every scene that he was in. So that was all great. And then for all that Ramsey was like talking a lot, he pulls it off really well because Sandile is a very great actor. So it wasn't, you know, just lame exposition. It came off as actually threatening. Like, here, this is like, you know, I have something to give you. I have something to offer, which actually made him interesting, which is something I can't say for the most part. Like, it started off well for him, and then he kind of, the tension dropped off, and he kind of disappeared for a little while, and now he finally has something.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. So all of that was great. Everything in Barry's head was phenomenal. Outside of that, I really like that we finally have hopefully what will be a great storyline in 6B that it's being set up now about Black Hole, and clearly somebody's after them. It's a very secretive organization, and I like that Iris and her staff are at the forefront of all of that going down, and that they're, you know, like that scene where they turn around towards the camera. It's like, you know, this is going to get really hard and dangerous. Are you in this with me? And they're like, yeah, we're not leaving. So I really like that. I think somebody, I don't know who it was on Twitter, was like, I'm going to tell my kids that these were the Charlie's Angels.
I love that. I really love that. So the shot when they like all turned, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I love that.
It was great. It's like their cinematic, own little superhero team.
Yeah, it was great. And I really liked the fact that finally somebody's asking Iris how she feels sort of about Barry's death. Because she already sort of, you know, she put up the headline, Barry's disappearing, but I like that at least Allegra mentioned that it seemed like she didn't have an intention of finishing the article, because maybe from what we can gather, she was still hopeful that something will change with regards to Barry's disappearance. Like, hopefully they'll, you know, Barry's prepared us apparently for crisis. So maybe something will happen, and I don't know, Nash Wells will come up with something that will save us, save Barry or something. So there's that hope. But her little voiceover while she was writing the article was really, really great, because her voice was breaking while she was doing the voiceover, and you could see
her tears
started flowing. So it was just great acting all around. Yeah. So what did not spark joy?
First, I'd like to say that I liked how we each had like a frost moment that we liked. So
leading into the frost moment that I did not like. That's for later.
Oh, yeah. Leading into the frost moments I did not like. Like I said, you know, I liked that she had that panic attack, because I think that, you know, obviously that's something I think that would have been very aligned with her character, and it would have made more sense. I think it would have came off even stronger if they hadn't had her playing Dr. Vim. The fact that they decided to make Caitlin and Killer Frost two separate people, but then they don't have a lot of, they don't put any investment in Killer Frost. Like, I feel like they thought Vocal Fry and some colored contacts was Killer Frost's personality. And seeing as how in the beginning of season 6, it took away both of those things, it's like they don't really know how to differentiate between her and Caitlin. And I think because they don't know, maybe Danielle doesn't know either, because sometimes it does feel like her performance as Frost feels like Caitlin. Like when, you know, Ralph, when they first found Ralph, and she, like, a lot of times it just seems like it's Caitlin with a white wig on and not Killer Frost. Like if you compare it to Katie Cassidy in Earth 1 Laurel and Earth 2 Laurel, you know, it's kind of similar, except, you know, they are two very different people, and E2 Laurel's right. had a full life of experiences. So she's had that kind of like fully formed background. But even when she came into Earth 1, and at first she was pretending to be Earth 1 Laurel, and now she is evolved into something else. But you can definitely tell the difference. Even though Earth 2 Laurel is not bad anymore, you can still clearly tell this is Earth 2 Laurel and not Earth 1 Laurel. Like, there's no way you get them confused. But with Frost, I feel like they didn't put a lot of effort into how she's different from Caitlin. So, like, her personality is supposed to be different. Her clothes and her taste in clothes and music and people are different. But just because she lived in Caitlin's mind rent-free for years doesn't mean that she should have the same aptitude in, you know, science that Caitlin does. Like, just because she was in her head when Caitlin went to college learning her biomedical science degree doesn't mean that Killer Frost automatically inherited these skills. I feel like if Caitlin is as good at science, then maybe Killer Frost failed at math at school or something like that. Or Caitlin is bad at PE and she's not really coordinated, but Killer Frost would have been like a Division I athlete or like the captain of a roller derby team or something. Like, there's something, there should be something that makes her just very specific from Caitlin, and there isn't. And so I feel like there's, that's why it comes off is that the writers really don't really know what to do with either character. They came to the decision that, they came around to the point that Caitlin should be out in medical situations. So I guess going forward, maybe they'll have like that kind of balance, but they haven't had that up until this point. So I don't know, hopefully. I mean, I don't really know what to what to hope for that, because it doesn't really seem like it'll change that much, but, you know, I don't know. Maybe they'll prove me wrong. Whatever. Aside from that, and that's not really, that wasn't really a dislike specifically about this episode, but just in general. But I think, like, for the rest of the episode, as the heart-wrenching and emotional as Grant's performance was, there was still one person's heart that was missing, and that would have pushed this episode to, like, God-tier level, and that's Iris. And fans have been complaining for weeks about the lack of her POV on Barry's death, and even if you follow, like, the logic that her spotlight was coming, like, in the final two episodes, like, you've been waiting the wait-and-see method or whatever, this episode proves that it's just lacking all around, and it's really amazing to me that 7 episodes in and only 1 episode to go before Crisis, like 36 hours in the universe time, and Barry and Iris have yet to have a plot line together since like episode 2. Unless you count the romantic getaway that they spent off screen in episode 5. But we have not seen them really together in the same plot since episode 2. And the most time that Barry has like spent with his wife after finding out that he was dying is inside his mind in this episode, really, talking about it, like getting the fact that he's dying. And I think that that should say something. Candace was really quick to let us know that they cut the Joe and Iris scene from this episode. She seemed like kind of like, oh my God, they cut it. Like, not upset, but like, oh no. And it, to me, like, logically in my mind, when I read that, I'm like, I feel like that scene would have been a follow-up to her scene with Allegra. I know, like, the promotional photos with, because there's promotional photos of Barry and Joe, and those were cut as well, so I'm not really sure if just Speed Force took on Joe's persona for a minute or not, but I feel like if it was Iris and Joe talking in a scene, that maybe would have been, like, a real-life scene, and maybe a follow-up to her conversation with Allegra that kind of really opens the floodgates, like, Allegra is the appetizer, and Joy would have been, like, the main course, and then that would lead to the final scene of her writing the actual article and being emotionally ready then to, like, actually type out some words. So that would have added a lot, I think, to the episode. And I think the fact that the only scene of Joe talking to his daughter about his husband's death that was cut, in my mind, is kind of ugly. I think the fact that neither Cisco or Frost thought to call Iris and tell her that Barry was stroking out and having a serious medical emergency. They didn't call her until after he was awake and walking around. I thought that was ridiculous. Someone on Twitter tried it with me, saying that what was the point, because it's not like Iris could do anything to help. And I'm just like, when a person is rushed to the ER for a medical emergency where they could die, you call a significant other, not because you think that they could do something, but because the person that they love is about to die.
Right. So, like, yeah, that's why hospitals have emergency contacts, not because right. they're like, so that's the roommate's going to definitely come and save this person.
Right. That's number one. But then number two, even if you, the show has proven that Iris has been able to save Barry when no one or nothing else could reach him time and time again. So even in the show context, that excuse that Iris couldn't do anything is, like, bullshit. And, like, all the Speed Force had to do was mention her name, and Barry, like, snapped out of his bloodlust immediately. But you think Iris wouldn't be able to do something if she were there? Like, okay, Jan, like, sure. But, I mean, like, we definitely know, obviously, because it's a part one, there used to be a part two, Barry has to fall to temptation. And if Iris wasn't there, then, you know, if she was there, then we wouldn't have a part two. So can't do that, can we? But I feel like, I mean, at least, you know, have them call Iris in the middle of it, and maybe she's stuck in traffic. I don't know, but she doesn't get there until the end. They could have done that, but it's just like, okay, Barry's not dead and he's awake. Let's call Iris now. And it's just like, okay, whatever.
Right, like all they had to do was just call her and say Iris is on her way, and then she comes and he's already woken up, and she says, that's right. Not Barry. That's easy. It's just easy. So I think that what this episode has proven is that, you know, as good as it was, and the fact that we finally got some Iris, you know, Iris' perspective, it was incredibly minimal, and it was literally Allegra, of all people, who was reaching out to her, the person who just showed up, like, 3 weeks ago, who doesn't know Iris at all. And as we've previously complained, like, I've always said, like, yes, it is in Iris' character to withhold her negative emotions, right? To keep it all in, let them bottle up. She doesn't want to, I don't know, burden people. She wants to be strong, whatever it is, right? That's a character trait, and that's valid, but the people in her life should be aware of that and trying to crack her open. Exactly. Yeah. Not accept that. Trying to reach out to her. Knowing that she's upset. Wanting her to open up. At the very least, her father should be like that. Her husband should be like that. And in previous, as for all of Todd's, you know, we're not even going to talk about the other one because we obviously would not want him. But for Todd's flaws, and I'm very happy that Candace is satisfied. Like, she feels heard by Eric. She's happy where she is. She's really happy with her pay raise. But but at the very least, there wasn't a doubt for me that Todd liked romantic Wes Allen, and that Todd was, like, willing to let people crack Iris's shell. You know, Iris mm-hmm. got to, like, yell at people, or, like, you know, whatever, open up about her vulnerabilities. And, you know, every once in a while people be like, hey, are you okay, Iris? And then there were, like, three episodes where they weren't like that, and we got real mad. But there was, like, three episodes where they weren't like that. This has been, like, seven episodes where people were like, Iris will be fine. And in this very episode, she was like, you raised us right, Barry. You totally prepared all of us. I remember when you took me on that exciting vacation off screen. So I am totally ready for you to die. So yeah, I think it's unfortunate, but Eric is not interested in romantic Wes Allen. This would have been a proper opportunity to showcase it if he was, and he didn't, because he's not. So we just have to give up on that. And cutting the scene of Iris and her father, for whatever reason, also shows that it's not, you know, the show's foremost concern at this moment to show concern for Iris. So again, unless there's something bigger and better in store, either in crisis, supposedly according to Guggenheim, who we now have to look to.
Oh, which is so weird.
There's a touching Iris moment. So, or maybe in part two, maybe because Iris is there, so maybe she will get to reach to him, right? And they just did that to stretch it out. But either way, it wouldn't feel as empty in this episode, the fact that we didn't get something for her like that, if we had been building up to it consistently. If we had gotten some check-ins for her up to now, it wouldn't feel as glaring that we didn't get one here. So, yeah, I don't like that. Thanks, I hate it. But we what else are we going to do but continue to wait and see? Other than, you know, not wait and not see, in which case you're not listening to this podcast. So, well, actually, you could be. Because even if you stop waiting and seeing, we would still be seeing and relaying that to you. So you need to listen even after you give up all hope. Okay, moving on from Iris. I think the Frost stuff, my biggest issue with it, I mean, I totally agree. Everything you said was so on point about the fact that we don't really know how to, or they don't really know how to distinguish Frost from Caitlin, right? Aside from apparently now Caitlin or Frost just can't do anything, right? Caitlin did all the things. And even though Frost was like taking over Caitlin for a prolonged period of time in like season 3, etc., she has no life experience whatsoever, doesn't understand emotions. So sure, why not? So of course she would not be able to perform medical procedures. It just doesn't, like, I don't know why they even thought that was a good idea. I don't know why they wouldn't have at the very least hired a temporary medic. It's not like they don't know doctors who know about the Flash.
I just think they don't have to, like, why not just call Caitlin? Like, when Caitlin was in charge of the body, she pulled out, she didn't try to go after bad guys as Caitlin. She called out Frost. So why can't it work
exactly
in reverse?
I guess it's like, because she's like, no, I have to live my own life. I have to be me, or I don't know, some nonsense. So I don't know. I think it's just super stupid and I don't get it. But anyway, aside from that, I just don't understand why they had to make it a thing. Like, what is the point of having Frost live her life? Except we're not seeing Frost do anything Caitlin didn't do. She's literally living Caitlin's life right now. And I'm not saying that I want to go see Frost live her life, but if they were going to let Frost, you know, have control, have autonomy, then what they should have done is done like a little mini Adventures of Frost, right? Like every episode you check in like one or two scenes of like, what is Frost discovering today? You know,
maybe she's learning to play guitar, starting her own rock band.
Like, because how is Frost going to really live a life if all she's doing is like, you know, actually like controlling the sim character of Caitlin's life? I don't know. Yeah. It just doesn't make any sense. So yeah, that's what I don't like about it. I just don't like that. It feels unfair to Frost because it just feels like the whole thing is just Frost is being Caitlin, and Caitlin's just sitting in the corner, probably telling her, "Oh, hey, do this." That's probably why they don't need a dumber doctor, because Caitlin's literally in the corner being like, "Oh, this is what you do next. Put the suture here." You know, like, okay, thanks. So yeah, aside from that, my biggest issue with the episode is just that this episode was so good and it did feel so tense and it did actually address crisis. So all of that was really good. And yet it proves that like the last 4 episodes have been filler, right? Mm-hmm. Why haven't we been consistently doing that for the last 4 episodes? Again, it's the same thing with like Iris not getting that big moment with Joe or not getting to like, you know, go in and pull Barry out of his mind. This episode would feel all right. Like, oh, we're just waiting for next week. If we had gotten to see her do anything in the last few episodes. It's the same thing. Like, why did we have to wait until the last 2 weeks before Crisis to really ramp up the Ramsey storyline? He's only got 8 episodes. How could we have 4 episodes of filler in an 8-episode storyline? And how come Barry is just now realizing, hey, he's going to die and miss out on his life? So, there you go.
Why is it even, like, a thing of Ramsey trying to take over the world 48 hours before it's supposed to, like,
right.
Die?
That's
true.
Yeah,
the time thing is weird. The time thing is weird. But
and also, like, when did his goal shift? Before, like, the last time we saw him do anything, it was like, oh, I had to kill people so that I can stay alive. It's going to be awesome. I'm just going to kill people while I stay alive. And now he's like, be my servant, Barry. And together, we will eat lots of people. Like, we've never seen him, like, I don't know. Like, obviously, he can control people through their blood. But we've never seen him, like, use that to, like, have someone do something significant and then love that, you know? So
yeah.
Sorry. Go now. Go me. Speak.
I mean, again, like you ladies already said, but my issues with this episode is primarily the issues that came before. But before I get to that, after watching the Arrow episode specifically, I was very frustrated with the Flash writers because here you have the monitor doing all these, showing Oliver these things, making Oliver go on these missions. The monitor doesn't know a man named Barry Allen, okay? Even though he's been hanging out in Central City, apparently, according to Nash Wells, he's just chilling in that rock tunnel. I don't know what he's been doing, but he's been doing something. I don't know if he's taking a vacation. Who knows? But after episode 2, he's like, you were going to die. And sure, Barry saw a bajillion futures where nothing goes well unless he actually sacrifices himself. But then all of that tension kind of died out. So he's, you know, ignored Barry since episode two, which is makes me wonder why they even had blood work to begin with when they could have been having Monitor driving the season and then introduce blood work for like a two episode arc where we would get something like this. And this is where the tension would properly build up, you know? So the primary downside, of course, was the lack of Iris and Barry's storyline. Like Jess already said, they haven't shared a plot together since episode two. And that's anger inducing considering that Barry's about to die, like 2 days, apparently he's about to die. And they have yet to discuss what that will mean for both of their futures. But mostly the issues with this episode, like I said, lie in the previous episodes, because it's not just a one episode issue so far. The fact that Barry's only just himself getting perspective on his looming death is a major oversight. Like Iris saying he's prepared them for crisis is a big old lie. Like, where has that been shown? Yes, he gave lessons to the rest of the Team Flash, but it feels like a complete waste because one, you can't teach people how to live without you, not really. And two, it wasn't really preparing them for crisis at all, because nothing really can. Like, the lessons that they learned aren't going to be about how to tackle what's to come. So this is why I was pissed off at Iris and Barry's lack of screen time in 6-5, because it was a good time to have discussed all that stuff, and they didn't. Like, they went away, and it was all off screen, and that was, like, the only time we saw them interact outside of episode 2 and then, you know, supposedly in 6-8. Then they decided to drop Nora into this episode, and as emotionally hard-hitting as that was, the fact that the season started off with West Allen mourning Nora, only to realize Barry would die before she was conceived, is like a big hole in both of their emotional arcs. And then someone finally asks Iris about facing that article, and it's Allegra. Joe and Iris' scene gets cut, so I can watch Frost like have a panic attack for some reason. For me, that her panic attack, it made sense, but the most annoying part about it is that we've seen Frost tackle how much she is not comfortable with death. She doesn't like want to die. She doesn't do all these things. So I feel like we've gotten more of that than both Iris and Barry tackling Barry's death combined, which is very frustrating. And then of course, Caitlin's medical knowledge, which you went over, and that's trash. But then Barry wanting to fight for his life, wanting to live because he had something to live for, I feel like should have been realizations he came to earlier on, you know, like earlier in the season. And it makes Cisco and Ralph's episodes feel very misplaced in the season. Like, we could have had Cisco mourning Cynthia in 6B. We could have had Ralph trying to find Sue in 6B. These could have been episodes like 10, 11, 12. Versus having them be in the middle of what's supposed to have been a very tension-filled 6A, where every episode should have built off of Barry dying. Like, it should have been Barry having lessons every episode that built up to this episode of him just finally realizing that he has something to live for, you know? So I just feel like in the days ahead of Crisis, you have Iris... Great that she's getting a journalism arc, but again, she's interacting with Barry's article and not Barry. And Barry is sitting there going, yeah, I prepared the team, but without, like, you finally get a Barry and Iris team in the beginning, and they're not even talking about that. Like, I just don't understand, because he hasn't prepared Iris. He hasn't talked to Iris about this, not that we've seen on screen after episode two. So it just feels like there's been a lot of, like, they really dropped the ball in terms of building up Barry's arc, emotional arc, where Iris would have also benefited. So they've both, the writers have slacked off in both of those points. So that's frustrating. So it was a very, very strong episode, but the issues like are just, they've been building up over the last four, which is very annoying. Feedback.
Let's see our feedback. Starting off with Paulina, because we left off with her on Black Lightning. She also has feedback for The Flash. The acting in this episode, the episode was a showcase for Grant's talents, might be his best performance to date, topping his Enter Flash time performance. Ooh. The scene where Barry tries to hold the baby Nora and his final confrontation with the Speed Force were both intense and chilling. Sendel was also great with the swap evilness, as was Candace, who got to have fun with the bloody dinner scene and brought the emotions during Iris's tribute to Barry. Her crying during the voiceover and as she writes the article were incredible work. I love that Iris was able to tell that Barry wasn't Barry the moment she spoke to him. These lightning rod keys. I love how prominent Iris' presence was during Barry's fever dream, even though Iris only had a brief, sweet moment at the beginning of the episode. The Speed Force even tells Barry that if he gives in and becomes Barry's vessel, he'll lose what Iris loves about him. West Allen and Baby Nora. Too much for my heart to take. I just want Barry and Iris to be happy and have their family together. And Team Citizen. Love the stuff with Iris, Camilla, and Allegra and the setup for the investigative plot in the second half of the season. Also loved how caring Allegra was toward Iris. It made me sad that we didn't get more of their solo scenes earlier. Dislikes. The show doesn't allow Iris a full range of point of view about Barry dying. This episode was a bit better, but she doesn't get to break down with Barry or Joe about the death. They cut the Joe and Iris scene. Yep. And we know, we all know that it was about Barry's death. We all know. So we are all upset. Keeping Iris and Barry apart during the last minutes of the episode. I know this was done because Iris had been able to pull him back before Ramsay took over, but it's just another egregious wrong done to Iris narratively. Just to not have her informed, like you said. And I think the show really dropped the ball on pre-crisis. They tried to scramble to get all the emotions in, so this episode felt a bit overwhelming at times. If they had paced it better, they wouldn't need to rush through this particular story arc. Indeed, there is no lies detected. All right, moving on to Mara. Mara has bullet pointed some thoughts on The Last Temptation of Barry Allen, Part 1. Grant acted his ass off. He really pushed the limits in terms of his performance this week, and damn did he deliver. The scene where Barry reaches out to hold Baby Nora in his arms, but can't and starts panicking. I'm tearing up just thinking about it. Baby Nora is adorable, and seeing West Allen with her was freaking emotional. Although Barry and Iris obviously had separate plots, I appreciated how much Iris and her importance was enforced in Barry's. Ramsay and Mama Nora Allen both appealed to Barry's love of Iris in different ways. This is true. Ramsay appealed to Barry's guilt. He manifested a widowed Iris in the morning clothes and asks Barry why he's so willing to make Iris a widow. And Mama Allen appealed to Barry's humanity and how much Iris values that. Speaking of, Grant delivered an incredible performance when he's yelling at the Speed Force for every perceived grievance. Yep. Coming back to the Speed Force and Iris, I loved how Mama Allen used Iris to appeal to Barry's humanity. When we finally see Iris sit down to write Barry's obituary, that's what she's talking of, the hero that he is and the sacrifice that he made. Candace is so good in the scene where Iris writes the article. Her voice is shaking, tears streaming down her face, an episode full of top-level acting. Team Citizen looked amazing. I love the setup for 6B and Iris getting to lead her cub reporter and photographer out in the field. I really like their dynamic. But the episode was not without its issues. This is true. And I like the scene where Allegra praises Iris's journalistic abilities and her eyes tear up. It's such an important moment to show that Iris is not okay, which is why it's frustrating that they don't let Iris break down with someone. And Iris Josie is cut. And I'm sure that it was her getting to voice her pain to her father. Also, Iris comes in and immediately knows that it isn't Barry, whereas those two had no idea anything was remiss. Yikes.
It's kind of interesting because it's like the way that he acted with them is no different from the way that they knew before. So it's like, what is that saying about your relationship, guys?
That's true. That's true. Anyway, who's ready for Iris West Allen to save her man? Tune in next week. And I do think that my issues with the plot force will be assuaged a little bit when she gets through to Barry. Overall, a very strong episode. And those are rare for this show. Ouch. All right. Suara! Hey, Suara. Hello, ladies. I hope everyone has had a great start to their holiday season. I watched The Flash last night in time to send y'all feedback, and this image encapsulates my reaction. Gordon Ramsay saying, delicious. Finally, some good fucking food. I know it's been several episodes, but the lack of Iris and Citizen content has been so incredibly disappointing and annoying, I skipped last week's episode because of it. Finally, we have an episode where she's at the center and also dealing with the grief of losing Barry. The shot of Iris, Camilla, and Allegra together made my heart sing. I love this song. Do I wish she had more scenes with Barry? Absolutely. But I get why she didn't. Barry's psychological journey was incredible. Both Grant and Candace brought their A-games in this episode. Ramsay made for a compelling villain, finally. It was great all around. I feel so fed. whether I have the confidence going forward based on the season's spotty track record of highs and lows, that's another question. Hopefully they keep the momentum going. Thank you, Suara. And Celeste. Here we go. Supergirl and Batwoman on hiatus. We miss you, girls. So here to talk about The Flash. 607 thoughts. The episode's intensity is exactly how every episode after 602 should have felt. This whole episode had me on the edge of my seat. By the time I was halfway done, I still couldn't believe there was more to be shown. It confirmed that all Barry really wants is to live a happy life with Iris and their daughter. I really loved the little touches, like how Iris was wearing the wedding band he got her in season one, and how her hair was styled like their wedding, and their first/second date. Rant acted his ass off this episode, had me all over the place within just a couple of scenes. When he gets good material, he shines. He shines. Barry going off on the Speed Force was much needed. The Speed Force's side of the argument was lacking and weak. I would have believed Ramsey over them, too. Allegra being the only one to check on Iris about how she's feeling is an issue. The strong Black woman trope that they have is so tiring. I'm ready for her breakdown already. I was sad and frustrated that they cut an Iris-Joe scene. We haven't gotten one between them since season 601, and they have not spoken once about Barry's impending death. Lastly, Iris being able to recognize that it wasn't Barry at the end, we love to see it. Ain't no one know Barry better than Iris. Overall, it was great. I have issues with the episode and 6A in general, but it was still enjoyable. I'm ready for Iris to work her lightning rod magic next episode to pull him back. And according to Candace, there are a lot of Sunshine Twin moments that I'm looking forward to see. Aw. We are looking forward to see it too, Celeste. Thank you for your feedback. Now, Shywan! I hope you all had an amazing Thanksgiving. Yay! Yes, we did, right? We all had good Thanksgivings?
Or I mean, I didn't have a Thanksgiving. Thanksgivings?
Yeah, exactly.
It was a nice Thursday.
Had a great Thursday. Thank you. All right. I enjoyed the episode, flaws and all. I enjoyed 95% of it. That's what she's going to say. She's just going to focus on what she loves. I love to see that. Okay. Everything about the struggle in Barry's mind about his fated death. It was emotional and exceptionally acted by Grant. I figured as time drew near, the reality of the situation would weigh on him more. The West Allen scene with baby Nora was so sweet, and seeing that awe and yearning on his face was beautiful and heartbreaking. Both the Speed Force and Ramsey used Iris as the ultimate bargaining chip to try to sway Barry. The Speed Force had to rush in to snatch Barry up at the loft because it knew he was about to choose life. I love seeing the rapid descent of Barry's mind and the anger and resentment he has towards the Speed Force. I enjoyed Iris' storyline and how it will play a big role in the back half. I liked seeing a little of her POV about Barry's pending death. I wish there was time for the scene between her and Joe. They should just release it now so we can see more of Iris' perspective. Oh, I love that. I totally agree.
Yeah.
I thought Iris having a fan and someone looking up to her like Allegra. Release the Iris cut. Iris having a fan looking up to her like Allegra is sweet. She's growing on me. Her knowing right away that it wasn't Barry. That's how in tune she is with her husband. She enjoyed this dinner scene, completely grossed out. Iris struggling to start the article was emotional, staring at the photo of the two of them, probably conjuring up sweet memories of the sweet boy she met, the young man that was willing to move heaven and earth to make her happy. Aw, gonna make me cry. She's trying to wrap her mind around him being gone. Barry giving into the dark side, negative flash in the building. I hope we get to hear more of Iris' POV next episode as she works to bring him back. It wasn't perfect, but still she was thoroughly entertained. The gold standard on full display. Thank you, Shy One. Does KJ have... Here we go. Oh, he hadn't seen Flash yet.
He's talking about
Titans there. So yeah, so we will come back to you, KJ.
Excellent. Predictions. So we can move on to the end of the least favorite show.
I do think that Iris is going to lightning rod Barry back to himself. So that's really the only prediction I've got. I think that it will be... great to see, and hopefully we will see a lot of it, and hopefully it'll be romantic and epic.
I mean, it's that, like, that's a given, and then Nash is finally going to break through the seven symbol door that he's been trying to break through for like seven episodes now. So and then it'll be time for Crisis. Mm-hmm. Like I feel like he won't even break through the door. Like the monitor will just be opening up like I've been waiting for you, Pariah.
I think if it's gonna happen, it'll be at the very end of the episode, and it'll go directly into the next. Yeah,
yeah, and like it'll be like Dakota, like it was this episode. At the end, monitor will open up, like I've been waiting for you, and then it'll be Crisis. It's like, yeah, okay,
yeah. I mean, this is not a prediction. I'm only looking forward to the next episode sort of paralleling the season 4 premiere, in which, like, Sisko was like, no, we need to get Barry back. And Iris was like, I'm still mad at him. He's gone. And now it's like the opposite, where it's Sisko's like, well, you can't get him back. And she's like, no, I won't give up on my husband.
Aww, yeah.
So it'll be nice to see.
Like, I thought that was an interesting, like, argument. Like, if you go, you're going to die. I'm like, y'all are all going to die.
I know. In like 24 hours, it's over.
Go for the wall.
Yeah. All right. Moving into our last and least favorite show, Titans. This is the finale. The Titans reassemble under Dick, who has now fully taken on the mantle of Nightwing, even though I don't think he actually mentions his name in the episode, to fight Deathstroke and attempt to save Jericho. But that's not the only struggle they face, as the team finds themselves up against mind-altered versions of Gar and Connor, who are now supercharged weapons at the mercy of Mercy Graves. And her Cadmus Final Phase 2 plan. It's Titans versus Titans in the epic season 2. Epic. LOL. Season 2 finale that's filled with surprises. What sparked joy?
Oh, it's over. No, I will say that I thought that Rose killing her father was poetic justice, and then letting, you know, Jericho, welcoming Jericho into her body, the brother that she had not met, and that the reason this whole crusade started, supposedly. So I was like, that works for me. The rest of that will be in the not sparks joy. But just that fact that happened. All right. And then I liked the Bruce and Dick scene, like at the wake funeral, whatever you want to call it, like the gathering post Donna, where Bruce was just basically like, oh, you've learned so much and you've grown. I'm so glad that you made up with Stu. And, you know, now that you're a dad, you see everything that I've gone through, like, whatever. Like, that was like sweet. I was like, okay, that's nice. I'm glad that they're on better footing now. Also, I liked the full circle of Gar and Rachel, you know, at the beginning of the season with Trigon. Gar was the one that pulled Rachel out, and then at the end of the season with, not ASA, Cadmus. With Cadmus, Rachel is the one that pulls Gar out, with a touch of a hand. So I love that non-sexual ship that will not become romantic. For many years to come. Yay!
I mean, if they keep leaving Gar out of seasons, that'll probably happen.
It'd be really easy. It'd be really easy to accomplish this. But anyway. So yeah, I really like that. Also, I thought it was, you know, sweet how they handled Connor after the fact. I'm like, oh, it wasn't you. Don't worry, Connor. And Connor's like, oh, but I caused all this. But yeah, I was like, oh, I feel for you, Connor. Sweet boy. All right. What else? I actually thought Hank's entrance was kind of funny. Like, he's like, I'm saving you, getting his ass handed to him. And then she's like, I was clearly doing just fine. So that was kind of cute. Other things happened. Help. Oh, okay. I like that it wasn't Bruce. I didn't really understand, but.
Oh, yeah.
When they were like, the
whole Echo episode.
Yeah.
Like, because we were talking about, like, how the fuck did Bruce, like, get into people's minds and, like, right, arrange a commercial to come on for Corey to go there? And it makes sense because, like, it makes sense now because, like, even in her conversation with Dick before she got on the plane to Themyscira, Rachel is telling him that she feels like her powers are getting weirder and that she's even able to go into Dick's mind and, like, make stuff come to life.
Yeah.
So that was basically, like, what she did with Bruce. Because I don't even think she had met Bruce by that point. So, but she went into Dick's mind and brought out his hallucination Bruce to hallucinate to the rest of the girl.
Yep. Which is why, yeah, like, well, that makes total sense. So, you know, that it makes total sense because Bruce could just have taken out the fucking phone and been like, hey, Bruce and right. Dick is in jail. So, anyway, why didn't you do that, Rachel? You should have made your hallucination Bruce pick up the phone. But anyway, it's fine. So, yeah, I mean, I don't really have anything else going on that I liked, so I'm good.
I agree with the kind of aftermath conversation between Dick and Bruce. It's kind of like Bruce this season is like a rare Pokemon that just comes up to frustrate you before it like runs away before you can catch it. But like his talk with Dick about, you know, being basically a father and the things that you have to do and what it means to have a family, and especially now that this tragedy has happened, and his advice to like not go in on yourself and not do the whole suffer alone thing, which you've been doing, and actually like lean on other people, was definitely something that Dick needed to hear, because he definitely is the type to do that. So that was some nice fatherly advice. I did like the saving, like when Dick went into Connor's mind and was like, you know, how can I help you? And Connor's like, I can't find the light. And, you know, Dick just like basically just starts like punching his way out to the light and bringing Connor into the light and all that kind of stuff. I thought that was a really interesting metaphor or dream sequence or whatever you want to call it. I thought that was cool. And then like Rachel, of course, saving Gar. The carnival looks cool visually. What I did think was funny was like when the girls finally showed up to the carnival scene, and they're all like looking at Connor and he doesn't recognize them, and they're all like playing like not it to figure out who has to go and fight Connor first. I like that. I guess like, well, Donna drew the short straw, and she seemed to be doing well at first. And it felt like this was the first time that the writers actually remembered that she is from Themyscira and gave her like the full use of her powers. I like that Corey tried to talk to Connor and Kryptonian. She's really funny. Like, even if she didn't have her powers, she would try to do things like, shit. This is what it feels like to not have any power.
That's right. That was cute.
But I did like that. She did get one good shot in. She punched Mercy in the face for Connor. So I was like, that's cool. Yeah. I thought that her and Dawn's like side conversations at dinner table, like about who, like, this is weird, like about the whole Bruce thing and him not being an Elko was, you know, good banter or whatever, but yep.
Is that all your likes, my dear?
Probably. Jericho's free. I guess that's cool.
Oh yeah, that's true. Primarily what I did like was Rachel saving Gar from Cadmus, and that she was the only one to get through to him because the power of platonic love will
platonic love. Power of non-sexual love.
saves the day. Yeah, so that was really sweet, and I thought that it was a nice callback to their season one relationship specifically, and again when she mentioned how he was the only one who was not able to, or who Trigon was not able to control in the season premiere, was really nice because it's just a reminder of how strong Gar is and how strong of a connection they have. So that was all great. But I just want to laugh about Donna's use of powers, because it's like she finally gets all of her use of powers right before they send her back to Themyscira in a funeral
in a box.
All of Corey's moments in general, I like the fact that Rachel got to heal her, and that she got to be a little bit funnier this episode, because she didn't have her powers and she just was always getting into, no, scratch that, just Corey being Corey. And I also did like Bruce's conversation with Dick, even though I feel like he showed up out of nowhere, because he's like the only adult of the primary Justice League who's like showing up when all these things are happening with the Titans, whereas like Diana's not around, Clark's not around. Right. So whatever. But I mean, it was nice for what it was. And then I also agree about Dawn and Corey's conversation at the dinner table, because what I liked about this episode that I didn't get to see in any of the previous episodes, not really, was that, like, there was banter. It felt like they were actually friends for the first time in forever. So it was not cool that we didn't get to see that before, but it was really nice that it was showcased here, because they were actually treating each other like friends do, you know, the little side chats and the little banter and the comedic moments and the serious moments in times of need and you know, all that stuff was present. So that was nice to see. I did think that Dick's suit was pretty cool looking. Like, I think it's very comic accurate.
Very nice.
Yeah.
I like his little batons too.
Mm-hmm. And I also agree that, you know, for all the moments that I thought that it was going to be Dick who actually defeated Slade, because it was meant to be, I guess, his storyline to do that. It was nice that Rose got her chance to get a good shot in and take down her dad, and then also sort of be swept into the Titans team and become sort of a member. Like, I like the little moment of when they're having dinner, Dawn sees her and kind of like nods her head and tells her to come over to sit with them, because she's like now accepted into the group, which is great. I think that is it of likes. What did not spark joy?
I forgot to say, like, I agree with you that they felt like friends, and I liked that little team up at the end, like, whatever the current lineup of Titans is, like, getting ready to go fight some crime. But that was nice. What did not spark joy was everything else. No, I feel like it was a mistake to try to tie up, like, three, or, like, lead into three different storylines mm-hmm. in the one episode, especially because I feel like they've been treading water and wasting time not leading up to those storylines in previous episodes. For, like, why did we need two episodes of Dawn and Donna tracking down Gar when what was going to happen was Mercy was going to call, like, a public auction and just put them there in the middle of, you know, a festival to, like, or a fair to, like, take each other down or whatever, or show that they can defeat evil, I don't know, whatever, you know? They didn't have to do anything. They could have just shown up at the last episode. So that was unnecessary. And then also, just, like, you know, Dick hasn't gotten a suit in a season and a half. He finally got the suit just so he can have a very normal fight with Slade, and then his daughter can come and kill him. And I was like, there is no sense of, like, ramp up. I didn't feel the rising action at all. It didn't feel like a climax. It was just kind of like the same thing. It was like Trigon, right? Like, mm-hmm. Oh, it's gonna come to a head. Oh, it's done now. Okay. Oh, I'm glad that's over with. So yeah, I didn't like that. Also, why did Donna randomly die with the, like, electric pole falling over? Like, no, I must save. Like, if you're gonna, you know, be a dark show and, you know, whatever, have people feel guilty about people dying when it's not their fault, then, you know, why not just have Connor kill Donna when he's mind warped? But anyway, instead she just dies because electricity was too much for her, I guess. I guess I like that she's, oh wait, that's a prediction. Just kidding. I'll talk about that later. So anyway, that was dumb. That was a dumb way for Donna to go out. I feel like she should have been able to survive that. I really hated that Diana did not show up for, you know, the funeral or whatever. Or, like, was even really mentioned, I think. Like, Rachel's like, I'm going to go to the mascara to see what I can do. But I'm pretty sure Diana would have something to say. You know, like, someone would be like, oh, God. Diana just really wants her body back. Or something, I don't know, something, you know, like, what? It's not, like, basically, like, when they were like, oh, yeah, we both have parents who are crime fighters, and I was like, is Diana her parent? Is that the parent you're talking about? And if so, where the fuck is she? So, yeah, that was really, strange. And then, what else? Oh, the third thing was, again, like, Blackfyre, like, it was set up all season, and then the payoff was, like, she takes over this poor lady's body. We've already seen her take over body. She was already on Earth. It's not different now that she did that. Just that I feel real bad for those kids. I'm very worried about them. I hope someone gets them out of that car. I hope someone, like, finds them a nice home. Like, but yeah, like, that's not, it, like, it's a cliffhanger, but it's not, because we literally have already seen her on Earth taking over bodies. Nothing is different. So, Don and Hank doing their little dance. Just get back together. I know you're going to eventually. Don't pretend like you're going to fake break up. Just whatever. And then they're just like sitting there at dinner right after. And it's like, they didn't just break up for the 300th time. And I was like, okay, sounds fake. Anyway, that's all.
Yeah. Like, there's just like, well, Hank and Don are over, but what about Hawk and Dove? Dramatic pause.
So, yeah. That's all.
I think it's like weird about like, because like in the beginning of this episode, Dick shows up in the whole Nightwing suit and he does his thing, but he never says he's Nightwing. But like, even in the previous episode where Stu and was Lily or the other woman's name are like making a suit, they were already making his suit before Dick even told him that he needed a suit. And the suit has like, you know, it has like the Nightwing symbol on it, the blue bird. And there is no input from Dick that, yes, let's put a blue bird on this suit because this Aloha Azul that I learned about and appropriated in the episode before. And it's just like, well, what was the point of the whole Aloha Azul mythology if it doesn't correlate to Bruce explaining, like, or not Bruce, but like Dick explaining, like, this is the kind of hero that he wants to be or the kind of suit that he wants and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I thought, you know, just like minor nitpick, but like the fact that he is Nightwing now without really verbalizing why he's Nightwing it's weird. I think like the fact that Slade is wasted as a villain, Cadmus was only like slightly better fully formed arc than Slade was. It's like Slade, you know, started out against this whole like vendetta. And it was even the fact that we thought that Jericho had some like petty feeling or like resentment. It was like, nope, he's been cool. He's just been stuck in a thing for 5 years. And this whole like agenda has been Slade being petty is just lame. And the fact that it went from being Slade versus the Titans to being Slade versus Dick, it's kind of like the writers are doubling down on all the other Titans being like, Dick, you were the bad guy in the situation. It's your fault, blah, 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 blah. And then like they doubled down on that. And then they didn't even let Dick beat his own villain. Rose defeated him. So like, you know, and now he's, you know, supposedly dead. So it's like, what was the point of the whole season? They wasted all these episodes stalling out to get to this. And they defeat him in the first third of the episode. Like I said, Cadmus was a little bit better form. I think Mercy was a better villain than Slade because she was more pragmatic about the way and the like the how and the why that she wanted to do things. I think that the plan would have been a lot better, come off a lot better, the whole auction thing, if they had actually expanded Gar's repertoire of animals that he could shift into, because it's like, oh, Connor can beat a tiger. Woo! Put in your millions and billions of dollars now, superhero villains, whatever. instead of like having like all this testing that they did to him to make him into their slave, and he's still only like a tiger. Like it would have been like visually cooler if maybe he started out as a tiger and Connor's like, bam, knocked you out, and then like he transforms into like an elephant or a gorilla or all those like animal shifts that you see in other mediums of the Titans, Teen Titans Go, all these other things where he's just like constantly shifting in and out into different animals. Would have felt like more of a challenge and more impressive watching Connor try to like react to all these different kind of changes. So it's like very disappointing still that even with Cadmus manipulating and trying to bring out Gar's best feral potential, and that he still can only be a tiger. So the disrespect to Gar continues. Hank and Dawn going through their little circle of I love you, I don't love you. You said you brought pain to the world. Yeah, but I was an asshole. You know, like all that kind of stuff. The fact that Donna finally felt like Themyscirian, is that a word? But like felt like she had her like strength. She used super speed for the first time to die. it just feels like they like finally remembered her full set of powers, only because they needed to kill her off in some kind of random way. And it was really like there was no purpose to her dying in that moment, and there's no reason why that she has to be dead, or why Rachel has to leave the season off screen with no like open-ended, like what was the reason for that? There wasn't really one. I don't know. It just, and like Connor is saying that, you know, this is my fault. And it would have been like a good opportunity to give Gar some focus as well, because Gar could be like, I killed all these people, it's my fault too. But it's kind of like just focus on like Connor, like saying Connor is okay, and then Gar's just like standing in the background. But like, doesn't he have feelings about this? I'm pretty sure he would have feelings about murdering a bunch of people at the direction of Cadmus, but they like barely brushed the surface of that in his talk with Dick. But his talk with Dick was more about Donna than about himself. So you know, whatever. Bruce, I don't even know why they bothered introducing Bruce this season, because like the most that he's done is like make tea and interrupt that broadcast by Mercy Graves. yeah.
The fucking tea. I was like, yes, Bruce Wayne making the tea.
That's it. That's all I got to say.
Yeah. The first thing I will say is that I hated the fact that Rachel got to say goodbye to her deadbeat father, but didn't say goodbye to her mother. Pissed me off. And then she didn't even talk to Gar before she left either. She just had this life-saving moment with him, and they don't even share like another scene.
Fake. She doesn't say goodbye or
anything. Yeah. It's just ridiculous. It's like,
it's kind of funny too, because she walked up on that plane like someone. I feel like someone in the plane would be like, "What the fuck?
Where are you doing?" Yeah, or like any of the Themyscirians are just like, "Hey, where are you going? Like, you're not allowed to come."
Like they didn't have like a pre conversation about Rachel doing this. So,
yeah, it makes no sense. It just seems like just a way to get her to leave and then come back next season with some more life experience and having brought back Donna, or who knows what else is going to happen, but it's just so, like, trash.
Magically being able to control her powers more.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah, exactly. Like all the struggle that anyone should have faced this season was not an issue on screen. There's like, but you had, you know, Corey's issues with her sister, Fide showing up. We didn't really get to explore that. Rachel was scared of her powers, scared of what they were doing. She was having like, she had that random episode where she was with that girl and that guy that she killed. That was never discussed afterwards. It was just like vanished from all everybody's memories, the writer's memories too. And then you had Gar, like you said, who went through this traumatic experience, and then it never gets discussed. And then they introduced Cadmus, and I was stupid enough to think that this was going to carry over into season 3, but then they defeat Cadmus too in like 2 seconds, and you had Bruce suddenly like his little computer whizzing online and then sending them little smiley face to be like, haha, got you.
That's like very Joker of you. Like,
yeah, it was ridiculous. I'm like, where did you even come from? So I don't know. It all happened so quickly and then ended so quickly. And then you had this whole buildup to Slade and this plan to keep the Titans apart. And then they discover Jericho was really alive. And then they're fighting Slade. And as much as, sure, Rose's moment of killing him was pretty cool because his, you know, it was her dad and he mistreated her and did all these things. But then again, they built Dick up. They got him a new suit. They did all these things for him. They had episodes upon episodes of moping and people being mad at Dick and the team breaking up to get back together abruptly without conversations being had about these things. And then all of a sudden he just kind of stands there while somebody else does the dirty work. Like, make it make sense. It's just so frustrating. It just feels like I've wasted my entire life, months of our time sitting here watching the show with no real payoff, because 12 minutes in and Slade is killed. Like, what kind of nonsense? It just, they don't know. The whole writer's team, number one, needs to be fired because they don't know how to write anything. Anything at all. There's...
and the showrunner.
So bad. Everybody and the showrunner. Everybody. Everybody has
clear
to go.
Clear and sale. All things must go.
Yeah. It's
liquidation.
Like, it's really, really bad. Like, we can be mad at any other show. It could be underwhelming. But there will never be such a season, an entire season, as trashy as season two of Titans was. Zero payoff.
Oh, my God.
And it just feels like, yeah, a complete waste of time. And then Dawn and Hank trying to get back together but not getting back together. I don't need to see any more of that drama next season. I don't care. And then... Donna's death, like, she didn't even go out heroically. I thought if they were going to at least kill her, she would have died trying to kill Slade.
One child and her dolly. What are you talking about?
Yeah, oh, speaking of the child and her dolly, like, everybody at the amusement park was seeing everything go down. And then all of a sudden, Titans are getting claps because they saved them. I'm like, Titans caused all of this. They don't deserve your clapping.
Right. Even like Gar and Connor were getting claps. And I'm like, hello?
They tried to kill you. They should be on the most wanted list. They shouldn't be able to go back to their lives like normal. What is this?
I like how the police are now not searching for Dick anymore.
Yeah, right? Like, he's an escaped convict or whatever. Whatever. It makes no sense. It's just like all of these little moments that they decided to have in an episode, but that made no sense overall. So this... throw this whole season away. We're done. It's
okay,
over.
But now, like, let's see what KJ has to tell us we're wrong about.
Do we have any predictions?
His feedback, right?
No, oh yeah, but okay. So we're doing feedback predictions? Is that what we're doing? Yeah, season two predictions. Okay. My thoughts by me. Happy Thanksgiving, Gumption Field ladies. Thank you. Except for Jessica, who just had a nice Thursday. All right. KJ says, I haven't seen this week's Flash just yet, but I will! Exclamation point. But for Titans, I enjoyed the finale. The fight between Deathstroke and Dick may have lasted a short while, but that's the issue of having season-long villains. The struggle lasts all season, but the fight is over relatively quickly. Which is why I like the show. The villain isn't around every episode or even a focus. By the way, we didn't see a body, so Slade, who can heal, is in no way dead. KJ's right about this, probably.
Not a body, but maybe like the body, like just
but KJ,
we didn't put that body in the ground.
Okay. We need to see Slade next season after the season. That's the real question.
Just giving his kids a W. I like that the action was over in the first half, so we could focus on the character beats. My favorite being Dick and Gar. Donna's death was the worst part, but even that may not stick due to my prediction. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, you know, his prediction that Rachel's going to Themyscira. You know. Hopefully to resurrect her or whatever, unless Rachel gets written off too, but I highly doubt this.
I highly doubt that.
Yeah. I'm glad we got confirmation that it was indeed Rachel who brought the other women to Elko. I am glad too, because otherwise, P.S. Season 1 was mainly Rachel's season based on the villain. This was Dick's, and it's standing to reason that Season 3 is Corey's.
And I think that's a good prediction, which means 4 must be Gar's season if we're going by that.
Right, right. That is a good prediction. I agree with all of...
Did you already read his prediction, you said?
Yeah, his predictions are that Rachel is going to Themyscira. Rachel will bring Lashana back. That season 3 will be Corey's season. And that Deathstroke is not dead. I agree with all those predictions.
Yeah.
However, I will say that this season being Dick's, it's not like there was a dearth of Dick in season 1. Like, Dick is most definitely the lead of the show.
Mm-hmm. And Dick will be all up in Corey's season. In season 3.
Will they remember that they used to be lovers, or is that going to be forgotten?
A long time ago.
You shall see. You know, Dawn's single now, so.
Oh, God. Whatever. Single and ready to mingle. But yeah, thank you for your thoughts, KJ, as always. I love your love of Titans. So.
Yes. At least someone's finding joy.
Exactly. Whatever sparks joy, that's what I want to see.
Lady with gumption of the week for side B.
Let's see. We had Flash. The Speed Force did its best. No, Iris, obviously. Iris confronting her feels, tracking down.
Or you could say, like, the Citizen as, like, a trio.
That's true. The Citizen trio. I accept that.
I don't know if I would count Camilla, because she wasn't,
you know what, it's a unit, okay? Leave her alone.
All three of them were in this Charlie's Angel shot to me.
Exactly.
For Titans, I would say Donna just because she died.
Hey, she saved had the that little girl, okay?
Yes.
Attempt to save the girl from electricity.
She died a hero's death.
All right, so for side A, we had Laurel and Anissa, and then Iris and Donna. So,
Or the citizen and Donna.
I would say Laurel. Or the citizen. Laurel for side A, citizen for side B.
I had gumption to write that article.
You wouldn't say Donna, though?
No!
Like, I feel like Laurel had...
It was die! I thought that was, like, an honorary mention because she died.
Laurel's was, like, psychological, I think. Like, she was just accepting what she already knew in her deep down in herself all along.
Yeah. I agree with that.
And then I feel like, I mean, Anissa, she asked her dad for help.
Yeah.
The citizen, I guess, like, we're starting to uncover a mystery. You know, Iris accepted what she knew she had to do all along and write the article. Then, like, Donna...
Died.
I mean, she fought Tanya. And then she, like... She died. I don't know.
Ooh, tough call.
Is it really?
I want to go with Team Citizen this week since Flash has gotten no love with the ladies.
I agree. This is the best way to
do it. Right for ladies. Damn it.
Yes. They should give us more for the ladies, but I will take it.
The Citizen?
Yes. Team Citizen.
Team Citizen it is.
All right. So there you have it. Team Citizen wins for Lady with Gumption. Ladies with Gumption of the week.
Yeah.
While maybe Donna will get one.
Oh my god, three Team Citizen ladies for us.
I know. And then tune in next week for all the rest of the shows will be back. And it'll be the week before Crisis. So with the week before our 100th episode, our 100th podcast. So please send us some love to ladieswgumption@gmail.com over on Tumblr, which I promised to answer some asks because Jessica's been doing a good job in doing some of that. And we have a lot. Ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. And we were also on the Twitter at DCTVGumption. We will see you next week. Have a nice rest of your holiday weekend. Goodbye.
Bye.